West. He's a funny one, he is.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
They don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you? Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
And welcome, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, lovers of freedom, fairness, and democracy, truth, justice, the American way. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. Tonight on the big program, we're going to talk with our good friend, Attorney Erwin Aronson, about the budget, the unemployment compensation fight, SB1, so much more. Your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Also in the first hour, Ted Kirsch. From the American Federation of Teachers, going to focus on the SB1 situation because, you know, you're still seeing the right, prancing out their Democratic allies saying, see, look, we've got a couple of Democrats, who we've paid enough to be for it. So follow them. Follow them down the road towards privatization. We're going to talk with Ted Kirsch about why this privatization scheme of education is a bad idea. And it is. From start to finish, it's a bad idea. We've been down this road. And it is. It's a straw man. It's one of these things where they're going to throw it out and say, oh, we're going to make education better. Because President Obama sends his kids to private school. You should be able to send your kids to school, too. I'm telling you right now, SB1 will not get your kid into Sidwell. The Sidwell Academy, not happening. Sidwell's still $33,000 a year. Giving me $9,000 is not going to get my kid into that school. As much as the right wants to tell you that that voucher is going to get you anywhere you want to go and they're going to have to take you, not the case. Also, we're going to talk with Tim Carr from Free Press about the AT&T situation with them taking over T-Mobile. In my opinion, they're going to monopolize. They're going to be two companies in this. And Sprint has filed a lawsuit because they're going to be the ones crushed in this, and they know it. So we'll talk about that. Also, Brandon Nida going to give us a little labor history. There's going to be a march this weekend on Blair Mountain, and for those who don't know labor history, Blair Mountain was one of those moments in worker history where you saw workers coming together to fight for a better wage, a better condition, actually a life. And in some cases, if you really look at it, their freedom. Freedom from the company store, freedom from the company housing, freedom from the company doctor, freedom from the company. And I go back to the friend that I knew up when I lived in Allentown who said, you know what? When he came back from Vietnam, he had taken the money that he had saved and paid the company all the money that his parents had owed. And that was the first time in his family's history in this country that they were not in debt to the company store. I mean, I just find that remarkable. That, you know, it was I think he said it was like 70-some-odd years that the family had been in the country, and every one of those years they were in debt to the company store. And it was only when he got home from Vietnam that he had a little money in his pocket, that he was able to pay that and free the family from the company store. just amazing. But this Blair Mountain thing, and it's going to be a little labor history. They're having a march to save Blair Mountain and say that it's a historical landmark because of the battles that went on there and the bombs that they dropped on workers and the use of the militia. And it's where the term redneck comes from, because as the story goes, they tied red handkerchiefs around their neck. And when they were shot down, gunned down, their bodies lay in the rain, and the dye from the handkerchief, you know, bled through onto their neck and stained their necks. Also in the third hour, Jerry Lee, president of the Tennessee AFL-CIO, going to talk to us about one of the laws passed down there. Again, you know, going to this whole theme of a war on workers, the state of Tennessee is passing a law, and as it looks, and Jerry Lee will be able to talk to it better than I can, they've set a maximum wage. And the maximum wage now is the prevailing wage. So anybody who's working in the construction industry, sorry, you're never going to be paid above the maximum wage. And, of course, no more PLAs, even though Tennessee's one of those states who's really never used PLAs. I think they had one, the Tennessee Valley Authority, but nothing else. So, again, it's this pushing the right-wing agenda, pushing it way out there, where the problem doesn't, where nothing exists, not even nothing. It's not even saying that we're going to take something away. There's nothing there. But again, it's following those right-wing principles, and it gives them small victories. See, we passed right. We passed no PLAs in Tennessee, even though Tennessee hasn't had one in 70 years. We passed one in Idaho, and I think they've never had one. It's kind of interesting. Anyway, so your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. We have got a long list of folks to talk to tonight. Have you been following the Where's Waldo? I mean, where's K Sera Sera tour? Have you been following the One Nation tour with Sarah Palin? Yeah, good luck. Nobody else seems to be able to follow her either. I was talking to somebody today who works for one of the TV stations, and they said they sent out a camera crew with the folks in Gettysburg, and they were standing there for hours waiting for the Palin bus to come by, which never did, and they were pretty ticked off about it. So I got to be honest, I'm kind of happy about it. I'm kind of happy because they're going to tick off a lot of media. They're going to tick off a lot of folks who for one reason or another, want to see this traveling circus go by. These carnies move their way through the Northeast. But one of the things I did find funny, evidently someone vandalized the One Nation bus. They took a sign and they taped it to the side of the bus. And look, on the side of the bus, it's a beautiful bus. I said this last night. Absolutely beautiful. The paint job that they've done on this bus is just, man, just remarkable. I mean, it's amazing. The craftsmanship, the quality of work. I'm in awe because I could never do it. I can barely draw a stick figure, let alone do the kind of quality artwork that they've done on this bus. And it's got the Constitution and a flag and just all kind of really patriotic, hyper-patriotic stuff. But somebody took a sign, and where it says, you know, we the people, they put this sign over, I the media whore. And again, I think that pretty much sums it up. And I guess the question then becomes, can we have this conversation? Is that sexism? Would we say that about a man who runs to the front of the line, who promotes themselves as well as she does? And you got to give her credit. She is an amazing self-promoter. She's the queen of this. But would we be saying this about a man? And I think the answer is yes, because I could easily see someone putting that on the Donald's bus. So again, you know, one of those things kind of funny. MSNBC, one of their anchors, this Martin Bashir, he brought up an interesting point. And it's something that, you know, I've had arguments with people over about for years. You know, ever since 9/11, we've kind of wrapped ourselves in the flag. And we've kind of made, you know, the great symbol of America and this great symbol of patriotism. And this guy Bashir asks, you know, a pretty simple question. You know, under the standards of respect and etiquette, you know, under the flag, the United States flag code, doesn't the code make it clear that the flag should never be used in any way for advertising purposes whatsoever, any way whatsoever. Yet if you look at what Palin's doing, you look at what a lot of people are doing with the flag. It's exactly it. I mean, I see these people with these beautiful these shirts, and I think her bust was framed after one of the really beautiful shirts with the flag and the Constitution on it. You know, the T-Twizzler shirts. Again, I'm not so comfortable with having my flag being worn like a common garment. But, you know, you got these people out there who, you know, they, for one reason or another, I'm going to show my solidarity with, you know, my other T-Twits. Even though the flag code, which, you know, I remember as a kid being taught, you know, as we stood at the flagpole, you know, raising the flagpole every morning. Maybe we don't teach that anymore. Maybe the folks like Sarah Palin never learned it. I don't know. But I've had this argument about the flag. And what's frustrating to me, and again, I don't think our flag should be made anywhere but right here at home. And this past Memorial Day, I had the opportunity to ask a number of people, can you tell me where that's made? And then to see the look of surprise when they turn the tag over and says, made in China. And again, it's not about the workers. And what we've seen in this country, and it's mind-boggling to me, that we're seeing this country under attack. The working people are under attack in this country like no other time. And when working people look at the flag, and I look at that one product, just one product out of millions that are not made here, and I ask, why can't we make at least that? Why can't we pass a law that says, you know what? The American flag has to be made in America. Why can't we pass a law that says, you know, the uniforms our soldiers fight, bleed, and die in, they have to be made here, not in Mexico, not in China. Why can't we do that? Well, we can't do that because we've got corporatists running our country on both sides of the aisle. We've got a government that is complicit with multinational corporations. That's why. Because it's all about the bottom line. And I got to watch the little Fox thing I did last night. And if you want to take a look at it, you go over to thericksmithshow.com. The video is on the front page. We're talking about, and it really kind of struck me. I'm talking about the jobs that were created. I'm talking about the communities that are thriving. I'm talking about the businesses that are now springing up and all of this positive economic activity that's growing out of this. And the person who I was, you know, the Cato Institute guy who was on the other side, his first club out of the bag is, what about the bondholders? And right there, you know, I couldn't, again, you know, when you do these kind of things, you don't see the people, and it's hard to hear because, you know, the equipment, a little choppy. But again, you know, this thing, the first club out of his bag was the bondholders. And had I heard it at the time, more clearly, I would have made the argument, look, this is exactly what I've been talking about on this show from the beginning. Which side are you on? Are you on the side of the working people, the people who get their hands bloodied and dirtied, or the people who have to come home at the end of the day aching and sore? Or are you on the side of the people who sit on their yachts and collect their dividend checks? And right there, I mean, and I missed it. It was one of those moments where you had a stark difference between two very different people. You've got me, and I'm looking at those auto workers saying, good for you, brother. Hope you keep it up. Support your community. Pay taxes in your community. That, you know, support local business. All of this stuff that we've been talking about. And then the guy on the other side, what about the bondholders? What about the investor class? And he couches in, well, mom and pop was depending on those bonds. Look, mom and pop didn't buy those bonds. The investor class bought those bonds. And had the auto industry gone under, those bonds would have gone with them. Simple stuff. But the attack on workers continues, and we're going to be talking about some of that today. Interestingly enough, the governor of Florida has signed a mandatory drug testing law for state workers, and the ACL is suing him over this. Again, you know, this is a state that's broke, but yet they've got $3.5 million to hand out to a brother-in-law, maybe to a campaign contributor, you know, one of those people, to make sure that, you know, those workers are under our thumb. Amazing. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with our good friend, Attorney Irwin Aronson, back after this.
right. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. The federal government is about to pay Grumman $310 million to make it easier to wipe out 3,000 jobs. Jesse Russell has more.
Northrop Grumman announced last year that it would be shutting down the Avondale shipyard in Louisiana. Last year, the company began scaling down its workforce of 5,000 employees. The shipyard is currently finishing work on what the company expects to be the last ship, and once the last rivet goes in, the remaining 3,000 workers will be out of a job. 500 small business owners sent a letter to President Barack Obama in May to ask him to encourage the company to sell the shipyard to a corporation that would continue assembling ships. They also asked Congress to stop a $310 million payment to the company, which would assist in shutdown costs. The corporation is expected to make a $120 million net profit from the federal payment. Last week, Republicans in the House voted to make the $310 million payment in spite of an impassioned plea by Louisiana 2nd District Representative Cedric Richmond.
And that's $310 million going to a company for quitting. That's not the American way, Mr. Chairman, and I would just ask my colleagues to support the amendment and not give $310 million to a company who just made $45 million in 3 months that's quitting on the American people.
Higher gas and food prices and wages that just aren't keeping up with those rising costs are hurting working family budgets. The U.S. Labor Department says there was a recent uptick in the number of people claiming jobless benefits, but workers don't need the Labor Department to tell them what's painfully obvious. The economy isn't growing nearly fast enough to replace the jobs lost in the recession while creating new ones in the numbers that are needed. Consumer spending is taking a hit in the face of the high gas prices, and there's no government stimulation of economic demand in the offing. Working families, already reeling from the high joblessness and high prices, have also seen home prices drop again to new post-housing bubble lows. An appeals court will hear arguments June 3rd on whether the NFL owners' lockout of players is legal. A federal judge in Minnesota ruled the lockout was illegal, but the Eighth Circuit Court stayed that lower court ruling pending an appeal. Players, meanwhile, have picked up support from the NFL Coaches Association in their legal fight to end the owner-imposed lockout. Pacifica Radio says it's riveting. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary for Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org. This newscast made possible in part by the American Federation of Teachers, a union of professionals. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Standing tall against a multinational corporate agenda. The Rick Smith Show.
All the things you want are real. You have you to complete, and there is no deal.
Well, you know, that's what it's going to take. If we're to stop these attacks on workers, if we're going to stop these budget attacks that are going to steal our children's future, these attacks on unemployment compensation that are going to harm those who lost jobs through no fault of their own. Again, you know, I look at that House Bill 916, and it boggles the mind that someone like Scott Perry would come out and say this is my work. This is what I have a vision for our state. It's really mind-boggling. When other states are doing some decent things, I look at what Maine did, and I give them all the credit in the world, and there's a bill going through our house right now that has some of the same language in this work sharing, which I think is a good thing. Had we had it back with the Great Recession under Bush, maybe you wouldn't have seen so many jobs lost. Maybe it would have saved us an awful lot of economic trouble. But here to talk a little bit about all of that and much more, our good friend, Attorney Erwin Aronson. Erwin, thanks for taking time for us.
Good to take time for you. How you doing, my friend?
I am doing fantastic.
Well, that's good to hear.
Everything is, you know, I look at this House Bill 916, and I'm telling you, I think we were part of the machine that stopped this thing.
Well,
because it was a bad bill.
It is a bad bill. It still exists. we need to remember that, yeah, it was the combined effort of working people in every corner of Pennsylvania who were able to reach out to committed Democrats and thinking Republicans. There's a hero in this. He's a Republican state representative from Bucks County named Gene DiGirolamo, who happens to be a loyal member of the General Assembly, a lifelong Republican, who was among the leaders who stood up against House Bill 916 and the Scott Perry Hall of Shame. And through Gene's good work and the good work of a number of other state House Republicans, working together not in a partisan fashion but in a Pennsylvania fashion, that stopped that legislation last week. But we need to be ever mindful and vigilant. The Scott Perry Hall of Shame unemployment compensation ripper bill was slowed down last week by a breathtaking vote, but they've already put up a reconsideration motion, and that bill could be reconsidered by the House of Representatives at any time, and it's going to take an ongoing concerted effort on the part of thinking Pennsylvanians, Democrats, Republicans, and Independents, to stop the poison.
We need to be vigilant and like the intro song, stand up and have our voices heard.
Absolutely. It's every week when I'm about to come on to this segment of your show and I hear that song, I'm reminded of what we're all here after.
Absolutely. You know, and let's talk about, you know, this work-sharing bill in Maine. Because, you know, I've been advocating for this for quite some time.
Well, you're not alone.
Well, I mean, the idea that, you know, we are all in this together. I mean, if you really truly believe that we are in this together, it's not about punishing anyone. It's about helping folks in their time of need, be it business, be it unemployed workers, be it employed workers. It's about helping everybody.
Well, the reality is it's more than about helping everybody. It is a recognition of good public policy. And that, of course, is what government is supposed to be about.
What? You mean it's not about partisanship and my team wins and you lose?
Well, you know, contrary to the current crop of people running things, it is absolutely not about that. Government exists for a reason, and the reason that government exists is to do things for people they can't do for themselves and to protect them from those who would take advantage of them. But, intriguingly, work sharing in its purest and most reasonable, simple form is simply good public policy. If we have a system that tells us what we have to pay to keep people unemployed, then we are always going to have some form of structural unemployment. If, on the other hand, we have a system that tells people that we're going to find a way to help you to continue to be participants in the economic life of our communities, those people will all be contributing members on whose behalf payments will be made to the unemployment insurance system, on whose behalf payments will be made right out of their paychecks in Pennsylvania into the unemployment insurance system. And so instead of merely being a situation in which we have one group of people who don't get benefits and another group of people who do, we'll share the work and do away with this disincentive in the unemployment compensation system to sharing work among the whole group of people. It will ultimately also allow employers to have an adequate, ready, trained, skilled, on the job workforce who otherwise would be in a position where some number of people are always out of work, their skills getting rusty, their attachment to their industries and their employment dissipating.
Right.
The problem with what is proposed in Maine and the problem with what has been proposed in Pennsylvania is that it's voluntary. And this is not the kind of system that ought to be voluntary. It ought to be mandatory.
And I agree with you on that. But, you know, when I looked at the Maine bill, it is a step in the right direction. And hopefully, you know, like many, many good pieces of legislation, it grows as people find it useful.
Yeah. I mean, my concern about it as I read the legislation in Maine, and even as I read the proposals that have kicked around in Pennsylvania, is that if they make it too burdensome for employers to volunteer to participate in a work-sharing program, then the employers are going to vote with their feet and not participate.
Right.
And we have the same kind of thing. It becomes an ephemeral promise. But conceptually, this is good, and it's a right and proper step. I think that as a society, we need to deal with some fundamental realities. As our United States, American workers, and particularly Pennsylvania workers, become more and more productive, as they have demonstrated they are the most productive workers in the world, indeed, we need to deal with the idea that we may not have enough jobs to go around if this is going to be predicated on a 40-hour week, a concept that was established nearly 80 years ago. And maybe what we should be moving toward ultimately is a 30-hour week.
So we could have full employment.
So we could have full employment. If we cut the number of hours by 20 or 25% that is in the normal work week, we increase the number of workers by 20 or 25%.
Oh, but Irwin, that sounds so French.
It sounds so capitalistic, okay? Because how does capitalism work? We either decrease supply or increase demand. And that's how capitalism moves. And that's what this is. This is capitalism. We working folks have one thing to sell. It's our labor.
Yep.
And so if we sell less of it, then there will be a higher demand for it. And that's what this is about. That's not French. That's a uniquely American concept.
Excellent point. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show with our good friend Irwin Aronson. Irwin, looking at the budget fight that is coming ahead, the Republicans rammed through their budget proposal in the House, sticking to the $27.3 billion number that Corbett had thrown out. Where do you see this going in the Senate?
Well, obviously, if they had the votes in the Senate to pass that poison, it would have passed by now. So that's not there. There's going to be some negotiation. There's going to be some back and forth. Among the House Republicans and the Senate Republicans, with a healthy dose of influence from the people of Pennsylvania. And once again, it's the same story. We need to continuously send a message to Harrisburg from every corner of Pennsylvania that says we're not going to put up with a budget that is based on helping the multi-rich and terrorizing the multitudes. And that's what we have now. When we're denying children access to education, we're denying people access to basic health care needs, when we're denying the unemployed access to services, when we're denying, as proposed, services to the disabled, we need to speak up and speak out. This is the role of government. This is not the role of the private sector. Left to the private sector, we would have disposable people in Pennsylvania. Left to the private sector alone, we would have two classes, the rich people whose children get an education and the rest of us whose children are denied access to a quality public education. We need to stand up and fight back.
I absolutely agree, but I would also argue, I do believe we already have that disposable society. I do believe that we've allowed a large segment of the population be pushed to the side, voiceless, because they don't have lobbyists and special interests to defend them.
Well, with all due respect, I don't think we've allowed that. I think that we have a group of elected officials who are getting away with it, and we need to expose them to the heat and light and sunshine of shows like this one that you fight for and keep on the air 5 nights a week, so that people get to hear the rest of the story, and in hearing the rest of the story, get an opportunity to recognize and to speak out against this injustice. The problem is not that poor folks don't have hired guns and lobbyists, but that there are others who do have hired guns and lobbyists who shield the members of the General Assembly from the reality of their community. And we need to reach out to members of the General Assembly, not here in Harrisburg where I am, but in the field, in their homes, in their offices, in their children's school bus stops, and let them know what it's like to have to make choices between medicine and milk and sugar and shoes, day in and day out, week in and week out, month in and month out.
Yep, and it's going to take people getting out in the streets, coming to the Capitol, and I'm hoping those things are going to be happening more often. We've been seeing it. We've been seeing people coming to the Capitol and having their voices heard. We've been seeing actions around the state. And I think all great things that need to happen more often so that our legislature hears them and sees them, more importantly.
Well, I think it's wonderful, fantastic, and absolutely appropriate for people to come to Harrisburg and to their state capital. But I think it's more wonderful and even more appropriate for them to pay a visit to their state house member on Saturday morning. And if they find their state house member in the office that's fine. But if they find them at the local coffee shop, at the local diner, at their kid's soccer game, or at Little League baseball field, that's an okay place, too. That's a really good place, as a matter of fact, because we have this disconnect all too often between what members of the General Assembly say at home and what they do in Harrisburg. And it's time for there to be a regular, ongoing, operational truth squad in each of their communities, just like people have been doing in Dilsburg and York County in the last week with respect to Representative Scott Perry.
Yep.
But putting ads on the radio, putting ads in the local newspaper, and explaining what it is that Representative Perry has proposed in his unemployment compensation so-called reform bill that got him into the Hall of Shame, gained his admission in the Hall of Shame as
well,
first member.
Well, I got to be honest. You know, when you're coming out and saying that this is the business bill, as he said on this program, you're going to get some shame somewhere.
Well, I got to be honest with you. I heard it on the Rick Smith Show first, and that was reality. That was the reality. I also heard Representative Perry say on your show and in several other places. I saw it in the news media, in the printed media, and I heard it on TV, and I heard it on your show how people from unions were engaged in name-calling, and he was going to address the facts. Well, I'm still waiting for the facts, but I heard him say on television just yesterday that he's fighting for the people and opposing the union goons.
The union goons.
And I'm proud to say I'm one of those goons. I'm proud to say I associate with a whole bunch of other people that I think he's referring to. But I'm thunderstruck and shocked that a member of the General Assembly, someone who took an oath to protect and defend our Constitution, has the colossal gall to suggest somehow that we have engaged in name-calling, but him referring to us as goons is somehow good government appropriate. And I'm still waiting to hear about those facts.
Yeah, waiting for it. You know, and here's the thing that gets me is I'm surprised at his surprise. You know, when I was a kid, you took somebody's lunch money, you hit on their girl, whatever, you got a response. This guy is he's taking from families who are struggling, people who are down, and the vast majority of them are not union people. And I think that's the important point I hear, that you have groups like the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO and other union groups who are standing up for all workers, just not union workers.
Wonderful point. I mean, you know, sadly, the vast majority of people who are eligible for unemployment compensation benefits today, whose benefits would be cut, whose eligibility would be restricted and reduced under the Perry proposal, are not union members. But the AFL-CIO here in Pennsylvania, under leadership of Rick Bloomingdale, president, and Secretary-Treasurer Frank Snyder, and, of course, the state building trades under leadership of Frank Sirianni, have not even looked at that question. They've looked at justice. They've looked at reality. They've looked at fairness. They've looked at what makes Pennsylvania tick and said they're going to stand up and fight for these people who are not their members because it's the right thing to do. And in that fight, by the way, they're also fighting for Pennsylvania small businesses that rely on the expenditures of the people who are eligible for unemployment compensation benefits to do things like pay their rent, buy their groceries, and go to the local drugstore.
Boy, there's a novel concept. Do the right thing.
Yeah.
Novel.
Well, maybe I'm still a starry-eyed, youngster here, even after all these years. But I really believe that there's a capacity for government to do the right thing. And last week, in the name of people like Gene DiGirolamo from Bucks County, as I mentioned earlier, I saw government work. I saw government work in a way that it was indeed doing the right thing.
One that I didn't think was possible, given the majorities that the Republicans have.
Well,
I give them all the credit. I give those folks who stood up and defended working people in the state the absolute credit that they deserve.
Well, you know, they deserve that credit. They have earned it, and they've earned it not because of being loyal to any political party or political philosophy. They earned it because they're doing their jobs.
Absolutely. Irwin, always great to talk with you. I appreciate your time and your insight. I look forward to talking to you again next week.
Sounds like a plan. Good luck. Thanks so much. Good to talk to you.
All right. Have a great night. Our good friend, Attorney Irwin Aronson. We're going to take a quick break. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. We're right back after this.
working class majority. Rick Smith.
I try to avoid religious commentary, but good God, what is it about confession that the Catholic hierarchy can't seem to grasp? The grotesque epidemic of priestly pedophilia that has roiled the church has been under assessment in a 5-year, $2 million study commissioned by our country's Catholic bishops. At long last, the report is out, but not the truth. Instead, the panel concludes that this horror is not the fault of the church, nor even of the abusive priests. Rather, cue the heavenly music, the 60s made them do it. Yes, it's the Woodstock defense. The diabolical theory of this study is that, quote, social chaos created by the tie-dyed sexual revolution of the 1960s so discombobulated otherwise chaste and honorable men that they used their religious authority to rape 10-year-olds and teenagers. Dios míos, have mercy! That conclusion is as perverted as what the priests did and as inexcusable as the hierarchy's ongoing denials and cover-ups. Start with the obvious. Rape is not about sex, it's a gross abuse of power. Second, I was around in the 1960s, and while I couldn't seem to attract much free love for myself, I can testify that the sexual revolution of the time most definitely did not even contemplate, much less advocate, old men in dark robes molesting children who had been placed in their care. This is Jim Hightower saying, the church's report is as silly as the right-wing's current fiction that all would be well in America if only the 60s had never happened. Excuse me, but enormous progress was made in those years by women, civil rights champions, environmental advocates, and yes, by American culture itself. The Pope should shelve this nonsense and lead the world in a new liturgical chant. Pedophilia is not a social habit that one adopts, it's a sickness.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
Well, you know, you take a look at what's going on in what the folks over at Think Progress call the subprime schools, which are right now the University of Phoenixes of the world, these private colleges, these for-profit universities who have default rates through the roof, but they've also got profit margins that are man, just to die for, CEO pay through the roof. And I look at what's going on in higher education, and Tom Harkin, the senator from Iowa, the Democrat there, has been holding hearings on this, looking at these for-profit colleges, saying, is this what we want to keep spending federal money on? Because understand, almost 90% of their revenue comes from you and I, the taxpayers. We're the ones who are funding this for-profit industry. And I look at the model that they've created for higher education, for these for-profit colleges. And I look at this model and I can't help but say that in 5, 10, 15 years, this is what my kindergartner is going to be looking at. This is what the fifth graders are going to be looking at, this for-profit industry where CEOs are making millions of dollars and we've got a failure rate through the roof. That's what scares me. I'm here to talk a little bit about SB1 and the voucher bill that's going through here in Pennsylvania. Is Ted Kirsch. He's the president of the Pennsylvania AFT, AFT.org. Ted, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me on, Rick.
You know, I look at this push towards privatization, and this is what SB1, in my opinion, is. It's a push to privatize education, not only to destroy teachers' unions, but also to have the investor class be able to profit and pocket taxpayer dollars.
Well, that's true, because we're talking about taking public dollars and feeding it into private schools. Once this concept goes through, we're going to have such a proliferation of private schools, quote unquote, and it's just as you were just pointing out about the colleges, it's all about making money, and it's really not a good thing for public education in this country.
You know, I just read an article by The Independent down there in Philadelphia, and they were talking about a new Democratic group who has just sprung up, and really it's just a rehash of an old group. They just changed the name to be able to issue another press release. But they pointed to President Obama's daughters going to the Sidwell Academy and how it's $33,000 a year, kind of conflating the fact that if you get this golden ticket, this special lottery ticket, that maybe you could send your kid to that $33,000 a year school. Kind of pushing that you could be like Obama, you could be like the investor class.
You know, it's one of the many myths about vouchers, and they say, well, this is school choice. It's not school choice for the parents. It's school choice. The school's picking the people. If you get a voucher for $9,000 and the tuition of, you know, Sidwell, $33,000, but take some of the private schools here in Philadelphia, $23,000, $18,000, $20,000, a voucher isn't going to get you in there, and it's just a myth that they're trying to sell to poor parents.
And even if you could, even if the voucher did cover it, that school doesn't have to take you. But I've had a state senator tell me that once I get that golden ticket, my child can go anywhere, and they have to take it.
Yeah, that's not in the legislation, and it never will be.
No, of course not, because like I said to him, I go, well, if I get this voucher for my kids, can I send them down to Philadelphia, down to the Abington Friends School, which is supposedly one of the better schools in the state? Can I do that? And his response was, yeah.
Yeah, get it in writing.
That's what I said. I go, then sign me up. I'd be more than happy to do it then, because there'll be a million people sending their kids to that school.
Yeah, and, you know, when we look at what's the battle happening in Pennsylvania right now with public education, where we have a governor that's taken $1 billion away from present schools, this voucher cost is another $1 billion. And it's being taken away from public schools, which was the backbone of this country. When you look at how did we get to be where we are? How did we develop a middle class the way we are? It was the public schools that gave us the opportunity. And, you know, it's just an absolute disgrace. What's happening and the arrogant attitude that goes along with the attack on the public school system.
But, Ted, you know that $1 billion you're talking about that's going off to create these for-profit ventures? That's not going to cost the taxpayers anything. In fact, you know, I love the guy from down in Philadelphia who said, it's not going to cost us anything.
It certainly is going to cost us. And, you know, what's worse is I've seen two estimates. On what the surplus is going to be in Pennsylvania at the end of this budget year. One is $450 million, another was $505 million, and the governor is saying, well, we need to save this money for a rainy day. Well, hell, it's pouring here. You have the money. You can fund it.
Yep, absolutely. And, you know, I look at one of the TV commentators you've got down there. I don't know if you saw this. I forget what his name is offhand, but he said, you know, he's in favor of the bill, even though it's not going to work.
Yeah, it must be a Fox broadcaster.
Yeah, it was.
Well, you know what? And I hate to say this, but, you know, Fox makes news. They don't report it.
You know, in fact, I think I've got the clip right here.
SB1 is not a perfect bill, nor will it fix our failing school system.
Patrick Pollini, the general manager of the one station down there.
They have a philosophy, and they're pushing their philosophy, and it's not in support of the public schools. They keep saying the failing public schools. Well, guess what? We are making progress. We are improving, and we have programs that we can be successful, but not if you're going to pull away funding. Right. You know, the worst part of it is we know research that kindergarten, early childhood is important. So many of our kids start behind, never catch up.
Yep.
To cut back kindergarten, cut back and eliminate early childhood programs, and then you're going to say the public schools are failing? You know, how? Why not?
Well, I mean, what it then becomes is a self-fulfilling prophecy.
That's exactly right.
If you can starve it at the beginning and you can cause it to fall behind, then what you have is a situation that the Republicans, in my experience, and a lot of, you know, pro-business types on the Democratic side, they create these crises so that they can take from the commons and give to private profit for profit interests.
Yeah, and it's not just the private aspect that we're talking about. There's also, and, you know, I'm not a lawyer, I'm a teacher, But I've read the Pennsylvania state constitution, and it's very clear that you can't be using public funds for, and the word is sectarian schools. You know, one of the biggest benefactors of the voucher will be religious schools. And it's very clear that in the Constitution that it shouldn't be. Now, that's clear to me as a non-lawyer, but when you get to the state Supreme Court and you look at where did everybody go to school, who knows what the decision will be.
Yeah, but there you go using your reading skills.
I'm a public school graduate.
You know, but here's the thing, and this is what bothers me. You know, we keep hearing this frame that the schools are failing. And I go, well, which schools are we talking about? Are there a handful of schools that are failing? I'm sure there are. And those are probably schools that are tied to high poverty rates. You know, building a brand new school in a falling down neighborhood, in a poverty ridden neighborhood, I don't know that it's going to make all that bit of a difference.
Yeah, it's not the building, and you're right. People are forgetting study after study. High poverty and success in school, they go hand in hand. You can't avoid it. It's a fact.
So for me, the answer is not just, oh, let's try something new because we haven't tried it yet, even though, like this guy says, it's a bad bill, it's not going to work, but he's in support of it anyway. Just because it's the next thing to do. I'm in favor of get your hands in there, get dirty, have longer school days, longer school years, Saturdays if you have to. Do what you have to do to help these kids in bad situations.
We do know what to do. There are proven programs that we can take kids who lack basic skills and give them that so they can be successful. It just takes the wherewithal and the commitment to do it. And this present administration is just walking away from it.
Well, what they want is they want to be able to be able to profit from it. And
well,
to me,
that's what it's about.
It's all about the money. And this disingenuous administration who's saying, well, we care about the kids, but, you know, money isn't everything. Well, you know, money's everything when you don't have it.
Yeah, and then, of course, we didn't touch on the fact that there is a source of money out there that could help fund the schools if we don't have the money. And, of course, we're not going to tax the Marcellus Shale. And you know what? There's a whole source of money. If they're saying we don't have the money, there is a source of money.
Yep.
But, no, we're not going to touch them because they contributed to my campaign.
No, I mean, there is the tax on drillers, which I'm all in favor of. Also closing the Delaware loophole, that money laundering scheme that we've allowed to exist for far too long. And, you know, hey, maybe we can start looking at taxing people who sell on the Internet. Times are tough. Why should they get a benefit that the store down the street doesn't get?
There are all kinds of loopholes, but it's the commitment, and the commitment isn't there from this present administration.
So let me ask you a last question. Where do we go to fight this back? You know, I'm seeing it kind of stalling right now, but there's still a little momentum left, and there's a lot of billionaire money going into this, especially folks from out of the state. What do average everyday folks like you and me do?
Well, I think what's happening is the public is becoming aware, and I think the public is starting to fight back when they realize how it affects them, their kids, their grandkids. People are beginning to see it. You know, when they talked about Senate Bill 1 on vouchers, everybody thought in 3 weeks it was a done deal.
Yeah.
Well, it got slowed down. The facts are starting to come out. In fact, now the Senate Majority Leader is saying we're not even going to think about it until the next session. So it has slowed down. People are becoming aware, and that's the way we're going to have to fight this and get this ship righted.
Yep. Can I give you a little advice if you take it?
I always take advice. You
know, right now is the time to kill this. Don't sit and wait till the fall. Kill this now. Get teachers out there.
We want to kill.
Get people out there. Keep fighting this now so that it never rears its ugly head.
Well, we are going to try, and we're not giving up, and we're feeling good only in the aspect that it's been delayed as long as it has, because they thought this was a steamroller. It's not.
Yep, and they thought they were going to just go in and push their agenda and bill up, bill down, passed.
Yeah, and they can't keep saying it's the teacher union. It's not just the teacher union. People are becoming aware, and they don't like what they see.
Well, now that you brought that up, maybe I have one more question. You know, because this is one of these things that's always bothered me. I've had very good relationships with my kids' teachers over the years, and I got to be honest. If I were a teacher, I would be demoralized. I would have low morale. I would have low interest being attacked constantly. This somehow that the teachers are the problem because heaven forbid they want to feed themselves and heaven forbid their family needs health care and heaven forbid they'd like to retire at some point in their life with some security. They're being bashed for this really just in the most nasty way.
Well, you're absolutely right. It is demoralizing. Teachers are beginning to rethink how much of a career they want to make it. And the younger people who are coming in, they're not taking it. They're leaving. We know statistically that in the first 5 years, and I'll use Philadelphia as an example. I know the statistics. In the first 5 years, more than half the people quit. So we're losing, what we're really losing are people who have that commitment to education, to kids, the frustration, the anger. Well, suddenly we're public enemy number one. Why? What did we do wrong all of a sudden? It's hurting the whole profession, and I worry about the level of people that are going to stay in as teachers.
Yeah, and we're not going to get the best and brightest in the future, because I got to be honest with you, I wouldn't, if I were a young person going into college, the last thing I'd be getting into is education right now.
That's the unfortunate part, and I think you're right.
Yeah. Ted Kirsch, president of AFT Pennsylvania, I appreciate your time. Thanks for the conversation, and keep up the fight and bash this thing down.
Yeah, we're going to keep it up, and thanks for having me on, Rick.
All right, Ted. Thanks so much. We're going to take a quick break right back after this, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You've reached Jenny in the Accounts Receivable Department of Den Supply International. I can't come to the phone right now. Please leave a message and I'll return your call as soon as I'm available.
Jenny was in constant pain and missing too much work.
I wasn't reliable. No matter how hard I tried, I couldn't be what I wanted to be. I knew that I could do my job better. I knew that I could be a better mom. I could be a better wife. But my body wasn't letting me.
Fortunately, Jenny's employer has Capital Blue Cross. And Capital gave Jenny a whole set of services called Better Health Works. Jenny filled out a profile, got online coaching, and called a nurse line.
She talked me out of a very dark time because I didn't know what else to do. Since I had my surgery, now I can give my employer and my family 110% of me.
Capital's Amy Montgomery is happy that Jenny is happy.
It feels great that Capital Blue Cross was able to help Jenny this way. We really believe in what we do, and I think that that's one of the things that makes us successful. I think it's a perfect example of when you care more, you do more.
Capital Blue Cross is an independent licensee of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
At PSECU, we know those holiday bills can really pile up and hit you with double-digit interest rates or fees that start to snowball. Next thing you know, you're buried in a mountain of debt. Dig out by using our 3.9 annual percentage rate Visa balance transfer, good through December 31st, 2012. That's a really big deal. And you heard that right. Our really big deal, 3.9% APR, is good through December 31st, 2012. And we don't charge you a balance transfer fee. So if you used any other credit card to pay for your holiday purchases, move those high interest rate balances to your PSECU Visa. The sooner you get in on this really big deal, the more you'll save. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or go to PSECU.com/life to get in on our really big deal Visa balance transfer. Don't wait. Start saving.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal opportunity lender.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Well, I know that somewhere down inside they're just feeling small and scared. And they need to know that someone out there cares. Have you heard of Republicans today? Have you tried to spread your love to those who love the NRA? Though they might be quite reluctant, cause they'll wonder if you're gay.
you know, to be honest, there are a couple of Republicans we should be hugging. And you know, as our friend Attorney Irwin Aronson said, you know, DeGirolamo is one of those guys who we should be, thanking, saying, look, you did the right thing on this unemployment comp bill. And there should be others that we should be talking to about this SB1, which is just horrible. Again, you know, I go back to this Patrick Paolini guy, this general manager of this TV station down there, who, like the clip says,
SB1 is not a perfect bill, nor will it fix our failing school system.
You know, if it's not a perfect bill and it's not going to fix the school system, why do it? But, you know, again, it's about the bottom line. And I love his rationale. And then this other clip, I just...
What other business pays you more money to keep failing?
Yeah, again, understand what he just said. What other business pays you money to keep failing? They have this vision of education. Somehow the education is now a business. And we should run education like a corporation. And to answer his question, what other business do we keep giving money to? I don't know, the banks. You know, in my lifetime, how many bank bailouts have there been in my lifetime? You know, I think of the Silverado savings and loan with Neil Bush. Remember that, Jake? The whole
Mr. SNL. Keating?
Yeah, Mr. Keating, the Keating Five. Real super conservative. In fact, Keating was one of those guys who fought vehemently against the Mapplethorpe photos being shown down in Cincinnati because it showed the backside of a child. You know, again, just kind of nuts.
I think he served 5 years in prison.
Yeah, well, you know, give me the money.
And he should have.
Give me the money. You know what? I'll serve 5 years in prison if you're going to give me a couple $100 million of stuff in my pocket. And you look at all of those criminals. Every one of them, they made out in the end.
But somehow, I believe the Bush, the younger Bush,
Neil.
He,
Silverado savings.
I don't believe he served prison time.
Never served a day.
Wouldn't have nothing to do with his daddy, would it?
Of course.
Nah, couldn't have. Nah, not, it doesn't happen in America, right?
No, well. According to the Wall Street Journal today, banks attempting to foreclose on homes, they're getting rebuffed by judges, saying that, you know, some of these delinquent borrowers are successfully arguing that their mortgages can't be shown to be owned by the companies that are trying to foreclose on them. These banks can't prove that they have the loans, and therefore they don't have the right to foreclose. I think it's amazing and good for these people, good for folks to stand up and fight back. These banks have been getting away with high crimes and no misdemeanors. These are high crimes. Just remarkable. Also, a report from the Center for Responsive Politics, they found 488 different organizations. You know, companies, trade associations, you know, lobbying groups, all of these different lobbying firms, lobbying on the implementation of Dodd-Frank, you know, the financial reform law that that went through in the first 3 months of 2011. The Center for Responsive Politics notes that nearly as many organizations that lobbied on it during the entire 2009, when the proposal was being making its way through Congress, same thing. What you're seeing now is Wall Street banks are spending more in 2011 to undermine Dodd-Frank than they spent in attempting to shape it. And that's one of these things that I think is important to understand. When they had the opportunity to say, look, here's how we do our business. Here are some very sane parameters that we should voluntarily find ourselves and say, look, you know, we got a little ahead of ourselves. The whole repeal of Glass-Steagall, bad thing. We need to step back a little bit on this. They didn't do that. What they did is they fought, and now they're fighting vehemently against the implementation, which is why you're seeing all the money going to these Republicans who are holding up Elizabeth Warren, who I think would be a great person to serve in that position. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Tim Carr from Free Press about the AT&T deal. Back after this.
Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. The federal government is about to pay Grumman $310 million to make it easier to wipe out 3,000 jobs. Jesse Russell has more.
Northrop Grumman announced last year that it would be shutting down the Avondale shipyard in Louisiana. Last year, the company began scaling down its workforce of 5,000 employees. The shipyard is currently finishing work on what the company expects to be the last ship, and once the last rivet goes in, the remaining 3,000 workers will be out of a job. 500 small business owners sent a letter to President Barack Obama in May to ask him to encourage the company to sell the shipyard to a corporation that would continue assembling ships. They also asked Congress to stop a $310 million payment to the company, which would assist in shutdown costs. The corporation is expected to make a $120 million net profit from the federal payment. Last week, Republicans in the House voted to make the $310 million payment in spite of an impassioned plea by Louisiana 2nd District Representative Cedric Richmond.
And that's $310 million going to a company for quitting. That's not the American way, Mr. Chairman, and I would just ask my colleagues to support the amendment and not give $310 million to a company who just made $45 million in 3 months that's quitting on the American people.
Higher gas and food prices and wages that just aren't keeping up with those rising costs are hurting working family budgets. The U.S. Labor Department says there was a recent uptick in the number of people claiming jobless benefits, but workers don't need the Labor Department to tell them what's painfully obvious. The economy isn't growing nearly fast enough to replace the jobs lost in the recession while creating new ones in the numbers that are needed. Consumer spending is taking a hit in the face of the high gas prices, and there's no government stimulation of economic demand in the offing. Working families, already reeling from the high joblessness and high prices, have also seen home prices drop again to new post-housing bubble lows. An appeals court will hear arguments June 3rd on whether the NFL owners' lockout of players is legal. A federal judge in Minnesota ruled the lockout was illegal, but the Eighth Circuit Court stayed that lower court ruling pending an appeal. Players, meanwhile, have picked up support from the NFL Coaches Association in their legal fight to end the owner-imposed lockout. Pacifica Radio says it's riveting. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary from Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org. This newscast made possible in part by the American Federation of Teachers, a union of professionals. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. You know, mobile carrier Sprint and the internet advocacy group Electronic Frontiers Foundation, this week they filed a petition with federal regulators looking to halt AT&T's $39 billion acquisition of T-Mobile. Again, you know, we've been talking about this for some time, and my take on this is I'm dead set against further monopolization of our communications, of our media, of corporate interests. I think monopolies are bad, and I think our history has borne that out. But how do we stop it? That's why I've asked Tim Carr from Free Press. Freepress.net is their website, to come talk to us a little bit about this and how do we stop it? What's wrong with it? Tim, thanks for taking time for us.
Hi, Rick. Thanks for having me.
You know, I look at this, and again, to me, what it says is more control in the hands of the few. I don't see how it's good for you and me.
Well, I mean, you know, there's never been a merger in the past that has actually created more jobs. And there's never been a merger in the past where you, especially in an industry where you have relatively few players, that actually has created more competition and more choice for the consumer. But this is what AT&T is claiming this merger will do. It seems like they're willing to claim anything in order to get regulators in Washington to rubber stamp this deal.
You know, I look at this, and, you know, again, it's kind of ironic that they're saying that there will be no This idea that when they combine these operations, there are going to be no job losses. I can't see how that's possible because, of course, there are going to be some redundant positions. There's going to be some synergy there where they can, you know, they can easily get somebody to do two people's jobs, as we've been seeing corporate America doing for the last 2 years since the Bush collapse. I just don't see it possible.
Well, T-Mobile USA it's owned by Deutsche Telekom, but it's actually a U.S. division based in Bellevue, Washington, and they have about 40,000 employees around the country. And what you'll see when if AT&T is allowed to merge with them is that they're going to shut down a lot of their call service operations, which are based in suburban and rural areas around the country. They're going to shut down a lot of their retail shops where you can go in and get your T-Mobile phone and sign up for your service. And they're also planning on decommissioning a lot of their cellular towers that are redundant, that overlap in AT&T coverage areas, which means job losses for technicians and others. So I've seen estimates coming out of Washington State alone, where they're headquartered, of job losses nearing 20,000.
And who's to say that those call center jobs don't end up somewhere like India?
We haven't really looked at AT&T and where they house their call centers, but it's a possibility that they could outsource that work.
So let me ask you this. You know, they keep saying that this is going to bring down prices, and I'm looking at the fact that they're spending $39 billion. We got to pay that back at some point. You and I are going to foot the bill for this. The only way I see it is through higher rates and less service.
That's a fair assumption to make. And in fact, T-Mobile, which has 34 million subscribers, is popular because on average they pay 20% less than AT&T subscribers. So if you're a T-Mobile user out there, as soon as your contract expires and they transition you over to AT&T, you can be expected to pay at least 20% more on your monthly bill. So, yeah, in addition to that, you're looking at a merger which leaves us going from four dominant players in the U.S. wireless market to really three, and really, really two, because Verizon and AT&T, if this merger goes through, will control approximately 80% of market share. So,
and they will
whenever
turn
you have fewer choices, you know, prices do tend to go up for everyone.
And they will turn around and crush Sprint.
Yeah, Sprint will be the lone third player here, and you know, it has such a dwindling market share, if this goes through, that it will be like, you know, a mom and pop shop trying to fight the Walmarts of the world.
Yeah, and that's what bothers me. You know, I keep hearing the folks on the right talking about competition. Well, we need competition in the marketplace. To me, this is not competition. This is doing what capitalism does. The big fish eating the little fish.
And that's been the case. And interestingly, with the wireless market, there's also an issue of spectrum. It's in order for you to be a player and provide wireless services to provide mobile phone services, you need to get access to spectrum. And you see the two big players now, increasingly, Verizon and AT&T, gobbling up access to spectrum, which is a publicly owned asset. And so they're not only monopolizing the market, they're monopolizing the airwaves. And these airwaves, you know, the airwaves are really important to innovation in the future. As more people use handheld devices to go on the internet, we need to make sure that we, you know, the U.S. government, the Federal Communications Commission, really controls the way that the airwaves are used. We need to make sure that those federal agencies ensure that we're doling out access to the airwaves in ways that ensures competition, ensures choice, ensures innovation for the consumers. And when you have too few players monopolizing so much of our public spectrum, you see these similar problems.
Answer this for me, Tim Carr. You know, I look at this, and I've had several people, you know, several of my conservative friends say, well, you know, once AT&T and Verizon are the kingpins, they're going to be big behemoths, and they're not going to be responsive to the consumer, and that's when you're going to see smaller competitors, local competitors sprouting up, so that we'll have choice to have local competitors fighting against them. And you bring up this spectrum thing that I don't think most people know much about, and it kind of makes me think that once these two become the behemoths that they're going to be, they gobble up all the spectrum. There's no chance in that scenario that my conservative friends keep throwing up to me.
Well, it's kind of, you know, it's kind of like saying that the your local hardware store is going to take on Lowe's and Home Depot.
Excellent point.
And in many cases in the wireless sector, it's even worse because they do need access to spectrum to really compete. So I think, you know, if the Federal Communications Commission and the agencies at the Department of Justice, which looks at antitrust issues, need to figure out how we can create good public policy that will allow for innovation and competition. And I think one of the keys is really in how we dole out that spectrum and to make sure that we need to really make sure that in every local marketplace there's enough available spectrum for competitors to come online and provide cheaper and more innovative products. I mean, if you go overseas and you talk to anybody who lives overseas, lives in Europe or in Asia, they'll tell you a completely different experiences with their cell phones. They have systems in place there where they really foster innovation in devices, and they're doing things with their cell phones that we can only imagine. So we need to look at how other countries have done this, what has worked for them in public policy to ensure competition and keep prices down, and we need to model some of our public policy after those sorts of best practices.
And they've actually got competition to where you're not saddled into two-year contracts and all of the painful costs of getting out of a contract, as I understand it.
Yeah, and those sorts of contracts where you know, if you were to leave your contract, you face these very steep termination fees. In addition to controlling the networks, these very powerful carriers also control the devices, and in many cases they control the sort of applications and the sort of things you can do with your devices. And by devices, I mean cell phones. So I think it's also important to try to pressure these carriers to open up devices so you can basically pick whatever cell phone you choose, whether it be the iPhone or be the Droid or be whatever new devices out there in the market, and basically take with you to whichever network you choose, and not have the carrier saying, oh, well, that cell phone, you know, those devices, those apps, we're not going to let you run those on our network. We need to open up, we not only need to open up the networks, but we need to open up the devices so that we have more choices there.
Yeah,
you have to think about how important cell phones have become to the ways that we live our lives. They're not just ways to, you know, you're not just calling your parents or texting your friends. People are now using them for GPS services. They're using them to help them find jobs. There's a whole range of things that we're doing with these mobile internet devices, and we have to ensure that those networks remain open and that the innovation over those devices helps drive our economy and empower users.
Yeah, I'm with you right there. In fact, one of my friends, he uses his iPhone to play the harmonica. You figure it out. I can't.
There's an app for that. Right?
Yeah, absolutely, there's an app for it. It's amazing to me that it works. But here's the thing. I mean, going down the road, if we see this mass consolidation, my concern is that innovation isn't going to happen because they've got you. Where are you going to go? You're going to go across the street? That's your choice.
Well, and that's been the problem traditionally in telecommunications. I mean, if you look at the history of the old AT&T, Ma Bell really only allowed one phone to work on their network. It was the old black rotary phones that many of us who've been around for a while remember. And, you know, it took the FCC and it took a public policy to open up those networks so we could do things like attach modems and attach answering machines to the old telephone network. But the old AT&T, Ma Bell, certainly didn't want that to happen. They were very content with having a closed network that they controlled. They were very content with having a single device, your rotary phone, which they controlled. And if we allow these monopolies to reemerge in the 21st century, you're going to see these powerful corporations begin to stifle innovation in the same ways that AT&T did in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s.
Yeah, I mean, I go back to this, that we've got antitrust laws. Nobody's enforcing them. That's my problem. And we keep allowing these massive mergers. I look at the Comcast thing. Again, another, you know, in my opinion, major mistake. You know, and I look to the FCC. What are they doing? What are they doing on this? Wasn't happy with the last thing, but, you know, what are they doing on this?
Well, the FCC has just, is in the middle of a process of getting public comments on this. In fact, earlier this week, on May 31st, was the deadline for comments, and there were about 28,000 to 30,000 comments that were filed by the public, and there, and more than 90% of them were filed by, you know, ordinary Americans, and all more than 90% of whom were adamantly opposed to this merger. The problem is that the other 10% were filings by very large, powerful corporations. So I think the challenge before the FCC is to decide, do we revert to business as usual as we weigh whether or not to approve this deal? And for them, business as usual is giving extra credence to powerful corporations like AT&T, which wields so much political and financial clout in Washington. We're hoping, and what Free Press, the work that Free Press does, is to try to persuade them to think otherwise, right. Persuade them to actually think that they're in office, they're serving as regulators to protect the public interest and not merely protect the interests of the very powerful money corporations.
So what do we do? How does an average Joe like me, how do our listeners help fight back against this?
Well, you can go to freepress.net, which is our website. We have we have an information page there that debunks a lot of the AT&T myths that they're spreading about this deal. And also, we have a real easy tool there through which you can file your own comments to the FCC and urge our FCC commissioners to stand up for the public interest and block.
Excellent. We'll put a link at our site at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Tim Carr's name. Last question I've got for you, and you don't have an answer for it, but which FCC commissioner will be taking a job with AT&T when this finishes up?
Well, we'd ask the FCC to pledge not to do that. Unfortunately, an FCC commissioner took a job with Comcast and NBC after approving that merger. So I'm hoping that none of them do, but, you know, the way the revolving door works in Washington between public interest, public sector employees and private sector employees, one never knows.
Yeah, it's time for them to cash in. They did the corporate work, now it's time to cash in. Tim Carr, I appreciate your time. Always great talking with you. Freepress.net is the website. We got a link at our site at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Tim Carr's name. Tim, thanks again.
Thanks so much, Rick.
We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
I try to avoid religious commentary, but good God, what is it about confession that the Catholic hierarchy can't seem to grasp? The grotesque epidemic of priestly pedophilia that has roiled the church has been under assessment in a 5-year, $2 million study commissioned by our country's Catholic bishops. At long last, the report is out, but not the truth. Instead, the panel concludes that this horror is not the fault of the church, nor even of the abusive priests. Rather, cue the heavenly music. The 60s made them do it. Yes, it's the Woodstock defense. The diabolical theory of this study is that, quote, social chaos created by the tie-dyed sexual revolution of the 1960s so discombobulated otherwise chaste and honorable men that they used their religious authority to rape 10-year-olds and teenagers. Dios mios, have mercy. That conclusion is as perverted as what the priests did and as inexcusable as the hierarchy's ongoing denials and cover-ups. Start with the obvious. Rape is not about sex. It's a gross abuse of power. Second, I was around in the 1960s, and while I couldn't seem to attract much free love for myself, I can testify that the sexual revolution of the time most definitely did not even contemplate, much less advocate, old men in dark robes molesting children who had been placed in their care.
This is Jim Hightower saying, the church's report is as silly as the right wing's current fiction that all would be well in America if only the 60s had never happened. Excuse me, but enormous progress was made in those years by women, civil rights champions, environmental advocates, and yes, by American culture itself. The Pope should shelve this nonsense and lead the world in a new liturgical chant. Pedophilia is not a social habit that one adopts. It's a sickness.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. You know, they're saying almost 1% of the households in the world control 39% of the global wealth. We talked about this last night, this study by the Boston Consulting Group. And you look at this mass consolidation of wealth And monopolization of wealth. I think it goes hand in hand with what we're talking about with AT&T and with Comcast and with these multinational corporations, these big behemoths that we've allowed to spring up around us. And again, you know, we keep feeding the beast. We keep saying, you know, we need to be more business friendly. We need to have an environment where business can grow. Well, you know what? The big monsters, these big behemoths, they're growing. And what they're doing is they're eating up everything on the ground. And what I love, Jake, is, you know, you hear these folks talking about competition. You know, we need to have more players in the marketplace, and this is where small business comes in. But if you have a behemoth like AT&T and Verizon, do you really think Jake Long's going to start Jake's cell phone service? No, you're not going to have that opportunity. So again, you're stifling competition. You're holding it down, and that's just not that industry. It's across the board.
Well, and the difference between that and difference between our country when I was growing up, you're talking 50s, 60s, 70s, from about 1980 on, you had less of enforcement of the antitrust laws. I don't see any of that anymore. There used to be a strict prohibition against that. And the system worked, and it worked well for the benefit of consumers, for the benefit of the country in general, for those who bought services. You don't see that anymore. And therein goes the problem that the middle class and workers have with the Republican philosophy. Republican philosophy is get government off their back. So inevitably what you have is the rich eating the poor and the weak eating the strong. And that's exactly what you have in corporate America. And that does not bode well for us as an economy or for the American consumer, Rick.
And what you're seeing, again, and you're right, this is where the poor get gobbled up. This is where the small companies get gobbled up. This is where mom and pops keep getting gobbled up. And I think Tim Carr made the perfect analogy in pointing out the Walmarts and the Home Depots against the small local hardware stores, which I used to love going into because, you know, the guy behind the counter, he knew everything in that store. You knew how to use everything. And if you went in and said, you know, I got a leaky pipe, here you go, this is what you do, this is how you do it, boom, you were done. You go into some of these big box, you know, they're just basically cashiers. And what's interesting to me, and again, you know, I try and bring this back home, who's paying the freight for everything that goes on in our society? And this Citizens for Tax Justice, they just released this new report laying out the tax rates of some of the nation's largest corporations. They chose 12 of the nation's largest corporations, and they found that during the height of this Bush recession from 2008 to 2010, that these 12 major corporations had profits in the $173 billion range. these 12 companies, $173 billion, yet they paid, well, a negative 1.5% tax rate. So they made $173 billion pure profit in their pockets, divvy out to the investor class of the world, who then paid only 15% tax, capital gains on that, plus they were able to deduct all their costs, and by the end of it, they paid virtually nothing. So all of this wealth, that we've put into these 12 corporations, and they point out General Electric, who we know pays nothing, American Electric Power, DuPont, Verizon, Boeing, Wells Fargo, FedEx, Honeywell, the same company throwing those workers out in the street because what? They want health care for retirees. Companies like IBM, Yahoo, United Technologies, and Exxon Mobil, they got all this money, made all this profit, and paid nothing in taxes. In fact, companies like GE actually got money back from us. We actually paid them to bring jobs here. Yet we've got folks, like the people I talked to last night at Fox Business, who are complaining that the auto workers have jobs today because we took a little bit of tax dollars and invested in those companies to help them through the rough time. Again, you know, in the perfect world, I'm against giving anyone tax dollars. But in the real world, I'm in favor of helping working people. And I go back to this, you know, and I missed it. I absolutely missed it. I'm kicking myself every day because the first thing out of that guy's mouth was, what about the bondholders? I'm talking about real families who have been struggling for years to put food on the table, keep themselves with clothes on their backs and a house. And these people are talking about, what about the bondholders? What about the investor class? Oh, what about that? Yet, here we go. You know, it's just, it's one of those things that's frustrating on so many levels. Just absolutely nuts. Anyway, let's go to the phone lines. I got Porkchop on line one. Haven't heard from you in a while, Porkchop. How you been?
Hey, how's it going, Rick?
Fantastic. What's on your mind?
You know, I'm listening to what you got going on here, and, you know, I'd like to add, hold on, let me turn my stereo down, so that's kind of weird.
Yeah, you don't want to hear it in one ear, not the other.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you were touching on how the top 1% and the top 2%, you know, controlling most of the wealth. Well, at the bottom and the beginning of the middle class rising, you know, the top 2% owned 24.6% of the income in this nation. And if we look at the statistics now, it's actually even more. And we're striving and struggling and we're fighting, and it's not as predominant because we're, you know, in a modern America, a modernized world. And I think that everyone needs to know and realize that that's what they want. That's what they're trying to do. And unless you want change, you got to do it. You know, you got to get up there and do it and contribute. And hello?
Yeah, I'm listening.
Oh, okay. The more everyone seems to realize that is, you know, the bottom line that you not talking conspiracy, but you take these huge conglomerates that are controlling all the wealth in America and, you know, in the world, because they are, you know, world national corporations.
Yep.
It is hard to combat and kind of process the whole thing, you know, as an individual. They need to realize that it really is. It's all about, you know, the people who are hauling the load.
Yep, I'm right there with you. And the reality is we have seen wealth inequity in this country grow to levels that we haven't seen since the Great Depression. We are on a crash course. You know, they talk about the alligator jaws. The wealth of the investor class going up and the poverty of those of us, the rest of us going down, eventually those jaws have to slap shut. Eventually you get to a point where it's going to bite somebody in the behind, which is why we're seeing some in the investor class saying, hey, we may need to be taxed a little bit more to stop that snapback, where the people at the bottom have nothing left to lose.
Well, absolutely, and it's not going to get all of us anywhere. I mean, unless we can all start working together, you know, again like we did, And again, you know, thank our founding fathers and, you know, the negotiating powers that have risen and the people that risen to create all of, you know, the acts that we have and everything else so that we can, you know, create this economy that is prosperous for everybody. You know, it probably all busts down to, you know, what happens to greed. And now we have, we're not just talking about America anymore. We're talking about, you know, this world economy.
Yep.
And how do you negotiate a world economy, you know, with corporations that's what they think of, you know, when their investments are doing great in this country and they're not doing, you know, good in ours? How do you even process all of that? And I think the American public needs to know that we need to start with ground zero and where we are at home and rise up so that we know and we can help them to help, you know, each other. And I was listening to your show, man. I just had to say something.
I appreciate it. I absolutely appreciate it. And no, hey, that's exactly what I wanted to hear, man, because somebody out there is getting this. We're getting through to folks because we have a serious problem. We have to fight back. And that's where I think having rational people in office to have a progressive tax code, pushing for a progressive tax code as opposed to what the right keeps pushing, this bizarre flat tax, is where we got to go. Pork Chop, I appreciate the call, brother. Call back again anytime.
Absolutely.
All right. Yep. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. We'll talk a little bit about labor history. The Blair Mountain thing is, to me, fascinating. So when we come back, we're going to talk with Brandon Nita. He's one of the organizers of a march this week to save Blair Mountain. We're back after this.
Together, we can make America better. The Rick Smith Show.
Do you need a sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
Now we all ought to feel just a little bit guilty when we look into the eyes of our kids. Cause brothers, it's a fact, if we take and don't put back, they'll have to pay for all we did. Let's leave some blue up above us. Let's leave some green on the ground.
That'd be a good start. You know, maybe start thinking about what we're going to leave for the future. You know, kind of like our parents worried about what they were going to leave us, the legacy that we were going to inherit. You know, I look back and I think of the things that my grandparents did, fighting for workers' rights, fighting for the environment, fighting for civil rights, fighting to make right now better than it was back then. And, you know, too often I think we forget our history, especially when you're talking about labor. Labor education, especially in this state, hasn't been taught, I don't think, for years. So we easily fall into this, well, you know, conditions have always been the way they are now. The benevolent corporation always gives to us because they're just good. Yet we don't know the battles. And it's been 90 years. This is going to be the 90th anniversary of the Battle of Blair Mountain, where you saw some 10,000 coal miners rise up against the coal operators and fight for just basic rights. The right to, you know, choose where they live, where they shop, the doctors that they go to, things that we take for granted these folks fought, bled, and died for. And that's why I think this weekend there's going to be a march to commemorate not only the battle, but also to save Blair Mountain, because I guess they want to level it. This mountaintop removal thing, just, again, you got a question. So I've asked Brandon Nina. He's one of the core organizers of the march. He's also an archaeologist who has been central in the preservation of the efforts to save Blair Mountain. Brandon, thanks for taking time for us.
No problem.
You know, I look at this situation and, one, there's an opportunity to educate people to say this is our history, but two, to look at a practice that I think is just horrible, and reexamine what we're doing in your neck of the woods.
Yeah, that's one of the kind of really interesting things about Blair Mountain is that it intersects all these concerns. It intersects the history of kind of how everything came to be in the state of West Virginia. It highlights some of the sacrifices that the coal miners have given, the ruthlessness of the coal barons, and what's going on now in West Virginia and Virginia and other places with mountaintop removal and kind of just a wholesale destruction of our kind of people, our health, and our mountains, our culture. So,
yeah, I look at we hear an awful lot about Don Blankenship and Massey Energy and, you know, how he was, you know, this ruthless CEO. To be honest, you know, looking back to this time that you're talking about, the 1920s, he's nothing compared. He's a piker compared to them.
He's a permutation of what they were doing. You know, one of the things about Blair Mountain is that the system that the coal miners were fighting against, you know, it hasn't gone away. It's changed and it's permutated, but we're still dealing with it. And the form that it's dealing with now is the Don Blankenships and Massey and Mountaintop Removal and Upper Big Branch. And so things are starting to go back to the way that they were in 1921.
So as one of the organizers of this march, and when is the march, and when are the exact dates?
We're having a kickoff concert June 5th, Hazel Dickens tribute concert, and then June 6th we're going to start marching. We're going to get into Blair, West Virginia on the 10th, and then on the 11th we're going to have a huge rally in the town of Blair with Emmylou Harris and Bobby Kennedy and a whole bunch of other people.
And, you know, the point of this march, not only just, you know, to make the hike, but also to educate and have conversations with people along the path, not only to educate them about the history of Blair Mountain, but also to try and save the mountain.
Yeah, exactly. The core kind of goals of this march are to preserve Blair Mountain, abolish mountaintop removal immediately in Appalachia, to strengthen labor rights, and to call for a substantial investment in sustainable jobs here in Appalachia. And so we've been doing a whole lot of just talking with people in the communities. And you know, I mean, people here, they know exactly what's going on, so we really don't have to educate them. But just showing them that you can stand up to the coal operators and you don't have to be intimidated, and that there's a huge movement of people that are working on this.
Well, two things. You know, you're talking about mountaintop removal. For those who don't know, can you, one, explain that? And two, some of the lines that I've seen drawn in West Virginia, there are those who they see mountaintop removal as a job source. What do you say to those folks?
Well, I mean, you know, that's put out by the coal operators, and anybody who believes a single word that the coal operators say, you know, that's just kind of you know, mountaintop removal destroys jobs. It destroys our health. And it destroys our communities. It takes substantially less workers to work on a mountaintop removal site. So what they're doing is actually taking jobs away from underground coal miners.
You know, a friend of mine, Bob Kincaid, who does a program on the Head On Radio Network, He gave me a book about a year and a half or 2 years ago, a show that of pictures, aerial pictures of mountaintop removal, and it is just that. It is whacking off pretty much the top of the mountain and almost leveling it off.
Oh, yeah. And so what happens is that they go in, they strip off the trees and the topsoil, and they just dump it in the valleys. And then they just start blasting the bedrock down to the coal seam. And they get all of that waste product, and they fill in valleys. And, you know, whenever you blast a mountain, there's a whole lot of chemicals that are trapped in the rock and the stratum. And so all that is exposed, and so it's poison on our waterways. And then, you know, to process coal, the whole processing kind of thing is extremely dirty. And so they wash this coal that they call clean coal, and they put it in these huge sludge impoundments throughout Appalachia. Earthen dam construction, you know, very, very unstable. And so the whole process is, you know, you're leveling mountains, you're creating sludge ponds that have billions of gallons of toxic slurry waste in them. And so the whole process is just, you know, I mean, like I said, it destroys our jobs, it destroys our health, it destroys our communities. You know, one of the communities that I work in, the community of Blair, right at the base of Blair Mountain, they have been systematically depopulated. You know, they go in, they close the schools down, they close the stores down, they start buying up property, they start inconveniencing people. And so, you know, these communities that have this really rich sense of community and just kind of, you know, neighborliness, they're all getting decimated by this process.
And I'm sure they're paying top dollar for the homes that people have spent their entire lives in.
No, I mean, you know, that's one of the things is once they start blasting, you know, with the mountaintop removal, I mean, who wants to buy that house?
Right.
And so the property values plummet, and then they just come in, you know, bottom dollar and buy these people out. And then those people, you know, whenever you're moving from West Virginia state to some other state, you know, I mean, it's a huge price increase. So, I mean, it's a really, really difficult process for the people here.
You listen to this, Brandon, and this is something that you would expect to have heard 100 years ago. Not something that would be still going on to this day. And to people here in Pennsylvania, I say this is our future as we look down the road to the natural gas industry as the drillers begin doing what the coal industry had done in this state for generations and what they're still doing in your state of West Virginia.
Oh, yeah. And that's the next huge environmental challenge is all this fracking stuff. And, And so that's one of the things that we're really proud of here in Appalachia is that we have this robust movement where we've been fighting the coal operators for a really long time.
Right.
And so, you know, we'll know how to handle these gas operators. So,
let me ask you this. You know, it's been 90 years since the Battle of Blair Mountain, the mountain you're trying to save. Is there any chance that you can get this, you know, save this one mountain from destruction?
Oh, yeah. You know, we have a huge amount of just energy on this. We have a lawsuit lodged in federal court getting to try to get it back on the National Register of Historic Places. And there's a whole lot of tools that we have to try to save this mountain. Sierra Club just now initiated a lands unsuitable mining petition, and that should be going through. But this is one of the most historic mountains in the United States. And it's also just one of the most pristine and absolutely beautiful places that I've ever been to, you know. And so if we can't save this one mountain, then there's something seriously wrong in America today.
Yeah, well, walk me back if you can. Do you know the history of Blair Mountain?
Oh, yeah. And so Blair Mountain was the culmination of about a generation of labor conflict in the coal field. And you know, started about 1890, and by about 1921, both sides were heavily militarized. Tensions were very high, and there was a strike going on in Mingo County, which is in the southwestern part of West Virginia, and martial law was called, and some other things happened, and the miners just kind of had enough of it, and they started gathering in Charleston, the state capital. And started marching towards Mingo County, and in the way was Logan County, which was a cooperator stronghold, still is today. And Blair Mountain was the mountain that they had to go over, and there was a private army entrenched on the top of Blair Mountain, about a battle line about 14 miles. And so the miners got there and started about a 4 or 5 day firefight. It was a full-on battle. You know, both sides had high-powered rifles, machine guns. The co-operators had private planes that they were dropping bombs on the miners. And so it was a full-on confrontation. They fought for about 5 days, and finally the federal troops came in. And federal troops, you know, a lot of the miners were veterans fresh from the trenches of World War One, and so they didn't want to fire on their, you know, brethren in the military. And so they laid down their arms and not a single shot fired. And from that, you know, a lot of those miners that were veterans of the Battle of Blair Mountain, those are the people who went on and organized the coal fields very quickly in 1933, and then went on to organize the United Auto Workers and United Steel Workers, because that was all done by the United Mine Workers, who organized, you know, the industrial unions. And so a lot of the, you know, labor movement and the middle class in general in America, you know, this is their battle too, because this is pretty much what created the middle class and the prosperity for Americans in the 20th century.
Now, those people who fought, bled, and died for the rights and benefits that we have today, and most people I don't think have ever heard of Blair Mountain.
Exactly. It's an extremely obscured part of history because it's people standing up to power, and it's open confrontation with power, and of course it happened in Appalachia and West Virginia, and this is the base of the American economy here. This is where the energy comes that fuels the, you know, the whole industrial revolution. And so the system that's been in place here is what has allowed that prosperity to happen. And so the exploitation and everything that goes on here in Appalachia and the poverty, that's done so that the rest of the country can have what's called cheap energy. Well, there's no such thing as cheap energy. Someone's got to pay the true cost of it, and it's been us Appalachians for 120 years.
And it's been the workers in the coal mines.
Oh, yeah. I mean, not just that, but in Illinois and Colorado and, you know, all those other places where coal has been mined. But, you know, they call us hillbillies and they, you know, all these other things. But those stereotypes, they just, you know, and cultural denigrations, they just mask the system that's been in place here and that we've been fighting against for 120 years.
And the website is marchonblairmountain.org. We've got a link at our site at thericksmithshow.com. Brandon, Nita, I appreciate the work that you guys do. Best of luck in your march and best of luck in preserving this this important piece of history.
Yeah, we're going to do it. We're going to win.
Already, and I'd love to have you back real soon to talk about it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks so much, Brandon. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Radio experience where hard work, common sense, and rational thought are a reality. The Rick Smith Show.
My name is Joanna, and my job is to protect children, to help them live in safe and stable families. I work for you, the taxpayers, in Children and Youth Services. Every day, I help children and families in crisis. Many parents have lost their jobs, making it harder to keep a roof overhead, food on the table, and stress under control. My caseloads are huge, and waiting lists for critical services are too long. Yet I know the safety of these children depends on me. Even in tough economic times, legislators must fund these vital programs. Because if we don't help these kids now, the cost to them and to us will be much higher later on. Children don't only depend on me doing my job, they're counting on you to care about their safety. Contact your state legislators today. Demand that they invest in programs that prevent and treat child abuse. Because a child in pain shouldn't have to wait.
Brought to you by SEIU Local 668. Visit our website at SEIU668.org and join our Human Services campaign.
Hi, I'm Bob Snyder, president of Teamsters Local 776 here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania.
For more than 100 years, Teamsters have been standing together to create a better tomorrow. We Teamster members are your friends and neighbors. Teamsters move goods across the nation, take care of seniors, serve and protect our community, and so much more. We are hardworking, dedicated professional workers, united to make our lives, our communities, and our nation stronger. If you want to be part of the team, join the Teamsters for a better tomorrow. Contact us at 1-800-692-6280. That's 1-800-692-6280. Or visit our website at TeamstersLocal776.org. We are people helping people.
Officially in love with Michelle Bachman, even if she's batshit crazy. Rick Smith.
Well, crazy is one thing. And I'm loving, I gotta be honest, I'm loving the 2012 Republican lineup. It is crazy from top to bottom. You want any variety of crazy. All of them are there. Your right-wing kooks, your social way out there on the fringe conservatives, the pizza man's there. It's beautiful. Just beautiful. I'm loving every bit of this. I cannot wait to go to the Republican, National Convention. Cannot wait. Anyway, I'm going to go to the Borowitz Report, written by Andy Borowitz. Advice from Davis Logsdon, a child psychologist, today from the Borowitz Report. He writes, as a prominent child psychologist, I know the struggles that parents go through trying to answer their children's most difficult questions, like, what will happen to me when I die? Why do people I love have to go away? If there's a God, why does he allow so much pain and suffering in the world? Could someone hack my Twitter account and send pictures of my penis to everyone in the world? Yes, these are questions that our children asked. And anecdotally, it's this last question that parents have been wrestling with the most over the past few days. As much as we try to shelter our children, he writes, they're not immune to the pervasive influence of the internet, as well as cable news channels, all of which have been broadcasting titillating details of Anthony Weiner's bulging underwear scandal on a 24-hour basis. Understandably, this has negatively affected our children's sense of security and well-being. Kids today live in a world that is confusing and scary, Logsdon says. Enough without throwing into the mix the fear of having one's penis secretly photographed and tweeted to the four corners of the world. He says, because I have dealt with the nettlesome issue so much over the past few days, I thought it might be helpful to publish the following tips to help parents talk to their children about Anthony Weiner's wiener. Could what happened to Anthony Weiner's penis happen to mine? No, writes Davis Logsdon. Anthony Weiner's penis has many followers on Twitter. Your penis isn't even on Twitter. Someday, when your penis gets much older, it may be on Twitter, but that's nothing to worry about because many people believe the end of the world will end before then. His advice is, if someday my penis is on Twitter and someone sends pictures of it to everyone in the world, what should I do? Well, his advice is pretty simple. Most people go through life without ever having their penis sent to everyone in the world. But if this does happen, just say the whole thing is a distraction. That's a long word, which means it's your penis, but you don't want to talk about it. Another question he has, could Anthony Weiner's wiener hack my wiener Twitter account and send pictures of mine to people? No, he says. Anthony Weiner's wiener is too busy to do something like that. And his last question, if there is a God, why does he let so much pain and suffering happen to Anthony Weiner's wiener? Well, the advice is God does many wonderful things. He made you and mommy and daddy and the sun and the moon and all of the food that we eat, but sometimes God gets bored, and that's why he made people who invented Twitter. Again, you know, I look at this, and this whole thing, I'm going to say is going to come back to Breitbart and bite him in the behind, but this has been a national story for the last several days. I mean, it's just nuts. Somebody hacked his account, sent out a couple of pictures of him, and now it's a national story. Just nuts. And I love John Stewart's defense of him, which is, it's not that big. It is what it is. Because Stewart and Anthony Weiner were college friends. They weren't roommates. They were friends. And he said, look, you know, it's not that big. Not that big. But, I, you know, Anthony Weiner going, well, you know, I can't verify for sure that's not mine. Okay.
I could see those two hanging out.
Yeah, well. And the woman who got the picture saying, look, I don't want to be in the middle of this. Please don't pull me in. But, you know, I blame CNN. Because they brought Breitbart on. Again, why would anybody give this guy 2 seconds of time? Because he's full of it, for the most part, to come on and say, you know, basically say that Anthony Weiner is a pedophile. That was his basic allegation. And even CNN said, gee, I'm sorry we did that. So I guess no more Breitbart on CNN. That's all right. I don't think anybody's watching CNN either, anyway. Energy policy. Let's talk a little bit about that. I got a couple of minutes. I want to get into energy policy a little bit. You look at what the Japanese are doing. Right now, you've got this horrible situation there. And the senior citizens of Japan, they're volunteering to go on what are for the most part suicide missions into these nuclear plants to try and help fix things and to try and help do some of the things that need to be done. They're called Suicide Corps, the Suicide Corps by one of the officials. And they said that, you know, they want to do the service to their country. They want to go in and they're going to risk their lives so that younger people can steer clear of this. To me, it's remarkable.
Actually, that fits the historical perspective of the Japanese culture, Rick. Very patriotic, self-effacing. That to me, is pretty much what the perceptions of the Japanese are to a lot of people. Very disciplined society.
And you look in the aftermath of what's going on at Fukushima, you've now got Germany, who on Monday said they're going to end their nuclear power by 2022, no more. So they're going to phase out completely all of their nuclear power plants. Angela Merkel, the chancellor there, said the decision hammered out by her center-right coalition overnight on Monday marked the start of a fundamental rethink of energy policy in what is the fourth largest economy in the world. Energy policy. They have an energy policy? Ooh. I wish we had an energy policy. Don't you? Don't you wish we had an energy policy? Because drill, baby, drill ain't cutting it. The invisible man, he's not cutting it either. anyway, Merkel told reporters, we want the electricity of the future to be safer and at the same time reliable and affordable, which is exactly why she could never be an American politician. What's this affordable stuff? Affordable. Who profits from affordable? The commission in Germany found that it would be viable within a decade for Germany to mothball all of its 17 nuclear reactors, 8 of which are currently off the electricity grid. You know, again, I look at this, and again, smart policy, looking down the road, having a plan. You know, I wish we had a plan. I wish we had leaders who said, you know what, in 10 years, I have a vision of what 10 years down the road might look like, and then work towards that plan. We can't pass something today. Just amazing to me. Anyway. Just plain nuts. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. When we come back, we're going to talk with Jerry Lee, president of the Tennessee AFL-CIO. Again, you know, you look at this whole push against workers' rights, this whole push to end those project labor agreements in a state that I think may have had one in the history of the state, which was the Tennessee Valley Authority. Just plain nuts. But again, here it is, you know, pushing this right-wing agenda, pushing it down the road, get good messaging going on. They're winning the war against those union people. I'm going to take a quick break right back after this with Jerry Lee. Stick around.
Smith Show, changing America for the better. The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. The federal government is about to pay Grumman $310 million to make it easier to wipe out 3,000 jobs. Jesse Russell has more.
Northrop Grumman announced last year that it would be shutting down the Avondale shipyard in Louisiana. Last year, the company began scaling down its workforce of 5,000 employees. The shipyard is currently finishing work on what the company expects to be the last ship, and once the last rivet goes in, the remaining 3,000 workers will be out of a job. 500 small business owners sent a letter to President Barack Obama in May to ask him to encourage the company to sell the shipyard to a corporation that would continue assembling ships. They also asked Congress to stop a $310 million payment to the company, which would assist in shutdown costs. The corporation is expected to make a $120 million net profit from the federal payment. Last week, Republicans in the House voted to make the $310 million payment in spite of an impassioned plea by Louisiana 2nd District Representative Cedric Richmond.
And that's $310 million going to a company for quitting. That's not the American way, Mr. Chairman, and I would just ask my colleagues to support the amendment and not give $310 million to a company who just made $45 million in 3 months that's quitting on the American people.
Higher gas and food prices and wages that just aren't keeping up with those rising costs are hurting working family budgets. The U.S. Labor Department says there was a recent uptick in the number of people claiming jobless benefits, but workers don't need the Labor Department to tell them what's painfully obvious. The economy isn't growing nearly fast enough to replace the jobs lost in the recession while creating new ones in the numbers that are needed. Consumer spending is taking a hit in the face of the high gas prices, and there's no government stimulation of economic demand in the offing. Working families, already reeling from the high joblessness and high prices, have also seen home prices drop again to new post-housing bubble lows. An appeals court will hear arguments June 3rd on whether the NFL owners' lockout of players is legal. A federal judge in Minnesota ruled the lockout was illegal, but the Eighth Circuit Court stayed that lower court ruling pending an appeal. Players, meanwhile, have picked up support from the NFL Coaches Association in their legal fight to end the owner-imposed lockout. Pacifica Radio says it's riveting. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary for Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org. This newscast made possible in part by the American Federation of Teachers, a union of professionals. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Volkswagen just invested in Tennessee, in a right-to-work state, at a low cost, with less health care. Why should we prop others up when other companies can compete in this marketplace? It's time to let these people learn the lesson.
You know, I know nothing, I see nothing, and I say nothing.
You know, I've said it a number of times. I'm sure Zach Womp is one of those people that folks would love to see leave town, especially talking about the auto industries. Now that it's coming back, that smart policy, smart investment has brought the industry back. We're creating jobs. Communities are seeing activity. Again, I think it's a great thing. Like I said on Fox Business last night, I think it is a good thing. I wish our government would have done more investing in infrastructure and in core functions of our national security, like I think the auto industry is. But we're seeing this all-out right-wing attack on workers' rights. And across the country, we've been seeing people going after collective bargaining, going after the rights of the use of project labor agreements, even in states that have never had a project labor agreement. And I look at the most recent one, Tennessee, the only one that I'm sure was the only project I know in Tennessee that was ever done under a project labor agreement was the Tennessee Valley Authority, which was very successful even to this day. But they have a law that they're pushing through their legislature going to ban project labor agreements in the state of Tennessee. That's why I've asked Jerry Lee, he's the president of the Tennessee AFL-CIO, to come talk to us about this and also the proposal of a maximum wage, it looks like. Jerry, thanks for taking time for us.
Yes, sir.
Tell me about this House Bill 1498. What do we got going on here?
Well, it not only outlaws the project labor agreements for public agencies, meaning state and local government agencies. I don't think they can touch the TVA agreement. But it also goes after any wage that's not set by the state or federal government. And in Memphis, Tennessee, they have a living wage ordinance. And there's an offshoot of this bill that they broke off because they wanted to pass it first. And it was an anti-discrimination bill against GLBTs for public contracts. And Nashville passed one this fall, and they preempted it with another bill, which was House Bill 598. It's just an attack on workers, it's an attack on unions, teachers, working people in general. It's been very, very intense, and I think we're seeing here the things we've seen all over the country and maybe even some new twists on this pattern legislation they're running everywhere.
Yeah, what was interesting to me, you brought up these local wage ordinances and the anti-discrimination stuff, and what the first thing that popped into my head is, you know, I know some of the folks from the folks in the federal government level from Tennessee preach the 10th Amendment, the states' rights issues, you know, local. It's ironic to me that the state, you know, in a state where they preach states' rights, would take away local control.
It's hypocritical, I mean, to say the least. It's very, very hypocritical.
Let me ask you about this project labor agreement stuff that they're trying to outlaw. How many project labor agreements have they worked under in Tennessee?
General Motors at Spring Hill was Saturn plant to begin with, and then they went back to the General Motors contract, and they've had a project labor agreement there ever since they've broke ground, and that was in the mid-'80s. So it's worked very well there on tripartite agreements where you sit down with the company or the contractor and the union and work out your differences and especially on safety issues and things of that nature. I mean, project labor agreements are very, very beneficial to everyone.
What I find interesting is, you know, they're trying to take the rights away from people to sit down across the table from each other. And part of me believes that they're just that bad at talking to folks. You know, when I look at the project labor agreement, I think it's a wonderful thing that it lays out all of the conditions. It lays out all of your wages, your conditions, your hours. Everything is right there. There's no guesswork.
That's exactly right. And on the TVA project agreement, there's a stipulation that work under contracts under $200,000 can be bid by anyone so that local people can get in on the act. And I think it's the same at General Motors here. There's always the ability for local contractors to bid on these PLAs. It's not a union thing. It's anybody can bid on it as long as they'll sign on to the contract that is.
As long as you can do the work.
That's right.
You know, but here's the thing. Here in Pennsylvania, they're trying to push the thresholds up to where you're at, $200,000, $250,000. And I make the argument that those thresholds, I would like to see lower so that they're bid, that people have an opportunity to bid on them, and we, the taxpayers, know where the bids are. Because if we, here in this state, I believe, if we raise those thresholds, we're going to open ourselves up to an awful lot of patronage and a whole lot of my brother-in-law needs a job, so we're going to give him one of these sideline jobs.
Absolutely, and you know, there's always a danger of them splitting the contracts and as is done in private contracting, where they split the contracts where they're all $200,000 or less or whatever the threshold is, where nobody can, a union can't compete.
You know, and here's the argument that I've made. Right here in this state, they love to say that, you know, if we could do away with PLAs and we could do away with prevailing wage, we could save 30% of construction costs, which we know is a red herring. It's not even possibly true. And there's no way to gauge that. But I would love to see if they're going to push this legislation through, a guarantee that I'm going to save 30% on construction costs, thus taking the profit away from those who would just put the wage difference in their pockets.
Well, what happens, they come in under a low bid, and if that's criteria, you know, you look at the work orders, for extras and things that they put in there, and the cost just skyrocket. Whereas when you got a project labor agreement, that really doesn't happen. You know, opponents of these PLAs, say they increase the cost, but studies by UCLA, Cornell, and other leading academics have concluded that there is simply no evidence to back up this conclusion, and that the studies upon which the critics of PLAs routinely rely fail to take into account other factors that influence the project's cost.
Yep.
You know, we've got the best qualified workforce in the world, spending up to $1 billion a year in private investments between the partner contractors and the unions and apprenticeship programs nationwide. Develops a workforce that commands a pay and benefit package reflective of their skill and productivity levels. And time again, these PLAs come in on time and under budget.
Yeah, it's an interesting point you made there, and I think most people don't realize that the building and construction trades run a really top rate training program where, you know, people spend years to become plumbers and electricians and all of the skilled trades, and they deserve a reasonable wage, a living wage with benefits and a secure retirement.
Well, absolutely. When you consider the factors in construction as seasonal, you don't work, you know, 40 hours a week, 52 weeks a year. You're out in the weather. You're out in all the elements, and you bring these skills to bear on these projects and stick this out. It they deserve all the compensation in the world they can get.
Absolutely. Let me go back to House Bill 1498 for a second, if you would. There's something in here that kind of confuses me, and maybe you can help me figure it out. They're saying that all public projects, they're not going to be able to pay higher than what the prevailing wage is. Is this a maximum wage?
Yes. It's state-funded public works is what the bill says. It prohibits public agencies from requiring certain wage requirements on contractors performing state-funded project works. And it also prohibits public agencies from requiring contractors to become affiliated with labor organizations or employee organizations. This is definitely just an anti-union bill, and I think this is retribution. They've got a lot of other bills that are very restrictive on our ability to contribute to political campaigns. While this year they passed a bill allowing corporations for the first time in Tennessee to contribute to candidates, and it's all retribution, I think, for union support Democrats in the past.
Man, you know, all this stuff going across the country, it's, you know, I understand it's all been written, you know, the Heritage Foundation or the think tank, the billionaire run think tanks in Washington. But it's just scary to hear that the same attacks that are happening here are happening in Tennessee and in Wisconsin and in Ohio and New Hampshire and all across this country. It's just scary stuff.
Anywhere they had a new majority, you've seen this appear, there are all these think tanks, you know, the Freedom Eagle Foundation, Eagle Forum on the immigration issues and religious issues, Chambers of Commerce, National Chamber of Commerce on these union issues, and it's just an all-out assault on workers.
So let me ask you last bit I've got, you know, looking at this House Bill 1498, it looks like it sets a maximum wage on workers. Is there any talk about setting a maximum wage on the owners of the construction companies, the CEO pay? Is there any talk of that?
Not at all. I just saw an article in the Tennessee and the Nashville newspaper here where they've got the 10 highest CEO company heads in Tennessee, and I think the highest one was like double his compensation to $15 million, and the second one was $8 million a year, you know, and then these CEOs are making 400 or 500 times the amount a worker makes, and that's just, you know, it's not fair. It's not the American way.
I got to tell you, Jerry Lee, and I look at this, and I think the guy who built the, put the roof on the school that my child sits in, I think he deserves an awful lot more than a CEO sitting in his cushy office collecting dividend checks.
At least a good percentage of that, you know, a worker should be able to share in the fruits of his labor.
Absolutely.
And all wealth comes from labor. It's no doubt about that.
Jerry Lee, I appreciate your time. Keep up the fight down there, brother. Love talking to you.
Thank you, Rick.
All right, we're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
I try to avoid religious commentary, but good God, what is it about confession that the Catholic hierarchy can't seem to grasp? The grotesque epidemic of priestly pedophilia that has roiled the church has been under assessment in a 5-year, $2 million study commissioned by our country's Catholic bishops. At long last, the report is out. But not the truth. Instead, the panel concludes that this horror is not the fault of the church, nor even of the abusive priests. Rather, cue the heavenly music, the 60s made them do it. Yes, it's the Woodstock defense. The diabolical theory of this study is that, quote, social chaos created by the tie-dyed sexual revolution of the 1960s so discombobulated otherwise chaste and honorable men that they used their religious authority to rape 10-year-olds and teenagers. Dios míos, have mercy! That conclusion is as perverted as what the priests did and as inexcusable as the hierarchy's ongoing denials and cover-ups. Start with the obvious. Rape is not about sex, it's a gross abuse of power. Second, I was around in the 1960s, and while I couldn't seem to attract much free love for myself, I can testify that the sexual revolution of the time most definitely did not even contemplate, much less advocate, old men in dark robes molesting children who had been placed in their care. This is Jim Hightower saying, the church's report is as silly as the right-wing's current fiction that all would be well in America if only the 60s had never happened. Excuse me, but enormous progress was made in those years by women, civil rights champions, environmental advocates, and yes, by American culture itself. The Pope should shelve this nonsense and lead the world in a new liturgical chant. Pedophilia is not a social habit that one adopts, it's a sickness.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Demanding the super rich to pay their fair share for once. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at TheRickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, go there, download our podcast there for your entertainment, your enjoyment, and convenience. If you want to contact us, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. I do answer all emails personally, especially the angry ones. And got a number of them after my appearance on Fox Business. Again, you know, this whole idea that how dare they help workers? How dare we have policy that's going to create jobs? How dare we? Which, again, you know, this is the whole reason that the Republicans swept into office. I think they forget this. And I think they're going to be reminded of it next November when they stand before the American people and say, this is what we've done. We've held the country hostage. We may crash the economy by not increasing the debt limit. We want to destroy Medicare and Medicaid. We want to destroy Social Security. We want to slash programs for veterans. We want to slash programs for the disabled. We want to cut education. All of these things that I think the American people are going, what? That's not what you ran on. You ran on jobs. Jobs, jobs, jobs. You know, and again, you go back to this time and time again, Jake. They ran on this, we're going to create jobs. One, two, and three, jobs, jobs, jobs. That's what my constituents are talking about. First thing they did when they took power? Turned on the insane, turned on the insanity. You know, do you remember back during the 90s, there was that weight loss woman, her name was Susan Powder, and she had her catch was, stop the insanity! Well, you know what, Republicans, you need to stop the insanity. Calm it down a little bit. Little Thorazine, little lithium, you know, the woman on The Sopranos, the doctor on The Sopranos, had the perfect line of all time. You know, with today's pharmacology, there's no need to be unhappy or crazy. Take your pills. That simple.
Well, I do remember the Tan Man saying they were gonna zero in on jobs. They were gonna concentrate on jobs like a laser.
Like a laser. Was that before or after he was crying?
Some laser. Some laser. That's all I gotta say.
And you know, again, I look at the White House, and I still believe. The president suffers from rabbit ears, you know, to use a baseball term. Because, you know, he was out there talking about, hey, we killed bin Laden. And the right said, wow, he's taking victory laps. And we haven't heard anything about it since. He was out there saying, look, we saved the auto industry. They're creating jobs. Communities are doing very well. The right's out there saying, well, you know, this was bad and he shouldn't have done it. And he stopped. I'm like, buddy, get out there and start tooting your horn a little bit. You've done some good things, this being one of them, rescuing the auto industry. And I go back to my grandfather who always said, you know, as GM goes, the country goes. Manufacturing, building stuff. You know, I just sit here and I think, you know, if the Republicans had their way, if the Zach Womps of the world had their way, imagine if they, stop and think, indulge me for a second. Stop and think of 1941, the day that will live in infamy. Think if all the car plants and all the steel mills and all of the manufacturing was owned by the Japanese, the Germans, the Italians. Stop and think about that for a second. What would have happened in this country? If all of your manufacturing capabilities were owned by somebody else. I mean, does that not scare you to your core? Does it not concern you that as a matter of national security, you better be able to build your war machine?
Mm-hmm.
And look, I think the guy did the right thing. Absolutely.
No, and here's the irony. The people who are buying our debt, and we hope that war never comes, but when you're looking at someone who would be a prime candidate to go to war with, is who?
Well, China. I mean, the Chinese, but at the end of the day, they can call in our debt. We can just say, if we're at war with them, say, tough luck. You're not getting it.
The Chinese or the former Soviet Union with just another name.
Or Walmart with an army, as I like to call China.
And their technology and their investment in that technology and corresponding investment in the technology which they put into their defense forces makes them a formidable military foe. Now, are we still the preeminent military power? Absolutely, no question. But
how long?
But it depends what kind of war we're going to fight. What are we going to tell the Chinese? Well, you know, we need about 6 months or maybe a year. Let's call a timeout here.
Let us have our industry back. Give us our manufacturing back.
Go back in your corner for a year, and then we'll come out and we'll try to kill each other.
And for me, that's the problem. If you don't have a growing, vibrant manufacturing sector, if you're not building things, if you don't have the capacity to do that, from a national security point more than anything, that's what scares me. That's what scares me. And what we've got is we've got a movement in this country who only care about themselves and their pockets. Simple. I mean, I look at the Comcast deal. As soon as the Comcast deal went through with NBC Universal, you had an FCC commissioner who jumped ship and said, I did your work. Reward me. And they gave her a nice cushy job. And I look to former Republican Senator Judd Gregg of New Hampshire. Back in January, retired. He now is an international advisor to whom? Goldman Sachs. Goldman Sachs. One of the people who collapsed our economy. But here he is, you know, one of the people who helped push through the big bailout, helped be part of that. Voted against the federal regulatory overhaul in 2010. Took care of them. Took care of them. And now they're going to take care of him. You know, this swinging door thing, man, has got to stop. Got to stop. And I think at minimum 5 years between the time you leave government and the time you go to work for the people that you were overseeing is a minimum, an absolute minimum. Another story out of New Jersey that I found quite amusing. Chris Christie, who keeps telling everyone that we're broke, the state of New Jersey's broke. We can't afford, you know, to pay for schools. We can't afford to pay those cops and firemen. Can't do any of that stuff. We've got to slash and burn the budget. You know, cut, 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 cut. Evidently, for him, not so much cut. On Wednesday, he decided that he needed to go see his son's baseball game, which I'm fully in tune with. I go see my kid's baseball game, coach the team, I'm right there. And as a father, got to give him credit, Chris. You know, good job. Go see your kid play. I just don't think you should be using the state police helicopter to do it. Sorry, just not there. Now, their rationale as well, you know, the governor has a tight schedule. And, you know, he wants to be able to fit in family plus do the state's business, which, you know, if he was actually doing state business, I might be okay with. Might be. You know, if he was trying to figure out how to make sure that the schools get the funding they need and the cops and the firemen get paid and make sure the teachers are taken care of and the community's working and the roads and the bridges are being taken care of, if he was doing that, might be okay with it. But the fact of the matter is he flew back to have a meeting with big donors from Iowa who are trying to get him to run for president. So I don't know that the people of New Jersey should be picking up the tab so he can meet with big donors from Iowa to further his political career. I'm just not getting that. And you would think when he was a U.S. attorney, he would have been one of the people right out there on the front line. If it was a Democrat doing this, if it was Corzine, he'd be out there just railing against this. But now that he's governor, you know, hey, justification. I wanted to go see the five innings, and I got back for the donor dinner. Amazing to me. Isn't that remarable, the hypocrisy? Cuts are good for you, Jake. Cuts are good for you, but not for me.
No, not to mention, he could have walked that last, you know, what was it, a couple hundred yards.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the man...
You know, I'm no slim pickings.
The man could be doing.
Maybe he can't walk.
He could be doing a few push-ups away from the table. I mean, he's no small man.
No.
I believe he's over the big 4-0. That is a big man. That's in anybody's jargon. That's a few pounds too heavy. But he's living a good life.
There you go. And he's got a helicopter to fly him around.
Apparently, the cutbacks don't pertain to his life.
You know, and again, you know, I look at this, and what's amazing to me, when Tom Corbett went to Washington to speak in front of the DeVos Family Foundation, the Federation for Children, on how to destroy public education in the state of Pennsylvania, you and I paid for that. We paid for the whole entourage to take him to Washington, D.C. They don't seem to have a problem using our money for their ends. But heaven forbid that we want education for our kids and roads that don't have potholes in it. I mean, you drive around Harrisburg here, the roads are horrible. And I drive around home in Carlisle, the roads there are just pathetic. There's so much work that could be done. So much work. You know, we've got, 8.5% unemployment rate? I could put that 8.5% to work tomorrow. Paving roads and bridges, picking up trash and painting people's houses and all kinds of stuff. I got work for you. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Ellen Ratner from Talk Radio News Service. We're right back after this.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Ask me, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? Ask Me Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, Ask Me Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME. We
the most important issues of the day. This is The Rick Smith Show.
Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Now to find out what's going on in Washington, D.C., our good friend Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Ellen, thanks for taking time for us.
Well, thank you so much, Rick. Lots going on, in particularly around the White House. The president had a meeting with the House Republican Conference. Tomorrow he meets with the Democrats. And Speaker Boehner called the meeting productive, but he urged Obama to approve spending cuts. Eric Cantor was also asked if the president expressed, because, of course, we weren't allowed to hear what was going on during, we had to wait till after, was asked if the president expressed interest in tech and a tax reform plan. He laughed. He said, the president talked a lot about investing, and he said to us, i.e. meaning the Republicans, that is a code word for more Washington spending. Then Paul Ryan said that he told the president to resist an urge to demagogue his budget plan. I mean, Paul Ryan isn't another planet, but okay. And a couple other members of Congress said, Republican members, that the president failed to offer a plan of their of his own to reduce the debt. So that was basically it.
Amazing. You know, this idea that we need to invest in our children's future and the future of the infrastructure of the country and the future of our nation, that's just spending that needs to be cut, I guess, in their eyes.
Exactly.
I wonder if the good socialist president, Dwight David Eisenhower, if he were faced with that kind of a statement when he was about ready to build the interstate system, I wonder how he would have responded.
Right. And, you know, I'm old enough. You're not that old yet. But I remember when they built the Eisenhower system, and it really was a huge difference. And, of course, that was a huge infrastructure development, and it was something that Eisenhower championed and everybody went along with.
That I really honestly and truthfully don't believe we could possibly accomplish today.
No, there would be way too much fighting to ever discover that or finish that kind of interstate system.
because I think the Republicans and the far right, they would want their private-public partnerships, and they'd want all of this investment money so that we could take public dollars, build something, and someone could profit from it.
It would be the old, you know, the old turnpike from the 1800s where some little person had a little piece of a road and they had a pike and they turned it when somebody wanted to go, and of course you had to pay a toll.
Yeah. Well, which is where they want to take us. Other good news for me, anyway, I hear Jim DeMint may be running for president.
Well, he said that he was asked by several of his supporters to look at it and that he and his family were going to look at it and he was going to think about it. Hey, listen, the more he's going to get in there, the better.
The more crackpots, the better.
I mean, do you imagine what Obama must have done? Can you just kind of see him flipping out? You know, and going yippee and clapping his hands, and when he got to mint.
I mean, when Herman Cain is number two, and you got Sarah Palin and Giuliani and all of these characters out there, Obama's really, he's got to be doing backflips.
This has got to be a very happy day for him.
But I'm sure that the people the people he's talking about are Boeing. Who he has been their greatest defender, the lawbreakers that they are, going out there trying to make this about, well, this is about people joining unions. It's all about that. Has nothing to do with it. It has all to do with a corporation breaking the law. Anyway, I don't want to get off on that.
I'm with you, my friend, on this one.
Beautiful. Another story. I guess we're going to be in with NATO and Libya for another 90 days.
It looks like they're 90 days. They're saying that these are the sort of final days for Gaddafi, but they were extending the mission for 90 days. And you know what's interesting is that over the weekend there were all these. All of this stuff going on and saying, well, eight NATO soldiers died in Afghanistan and all this. Well, of course, when I saw that, I thought, eight NATO soldiers died? Well, how many of them were Americans? And then it finally came through that like seven of them were Americans. But they sort of do it under the rubric of NATO, and right. Then later on you find out who's really behind some of this.
Yeah, and to be honest, you know, we are the ones who are taking a lead. And I got to be honest, if I were one of the soldiers, I don't know that I would want someone else leading me into the charge.
Well, that's certainly been an issue, to say the least.
Yep. Other news in that area, Mubarak, I guess, going on trial?
He and his son, they're going to, I guess, do a joint trial or something, but it starts on August 13th.
I'm sure they will find a fair and impartial jury there in the country of Egypt.
I'm sure. a country that, as you know, is not exactly fair and impartial on almost anything.
Like they say, what goes around comes around. News from Yemen?
Yes, the news from Yemen is something like 81 people were killed, and there is a lot of concern about that, actually. We do know that John Brennan is going to be going. He's the Homeland Security guy who's the assistant to the president. He's actually going to be going to Sudan, which is where I'm going to be going in 3 weeks. And hopefully, I'm actually taking somebody over, Rick, who can put all kinds of rural computer systems together. And hopefully we can come in on Skype to some of our radio stations or even in other places. And hopefully I'll do at least one show for you from Sudan.
Well, that would be fantastic. We would love to see you there.
But Yemen is not a good situation.
No, the whole region is not a good situation. You got to wonder, did we open up Pandora's box or was this just something that was going to happen anyway?
Well, I don't know, right. And that's a very good question. Nobody knows. And it also just may have been a time.
And lastly, here on the domestic front, the auto industry, I was on Fox Business News last night on one of the America's Nightly Scorecard or whatever it is, debating the auto industry and whether or not the loans that we gave to the auto industry were a good thing. And I say they absolutely were. We're seeing job creation. We're seeing communities coming back. But any information on that front in your world?
Yes. Well, as you know, Tim Geithner wrote an op-ed today has said a million jobs would be saved, but by anybody's stretch of the imagination, the auto industry is doing better. Now, if you look at the way that the White House and more the Democratic press issued it, they said, look, less than 20% of what we, of the $80 billion that we gave was going to not be paid back. And the Drudge Report then came out and said, you know, 13 to 16 billion or whatever number they said is not going to get paid back. So it depends on how you see it. What I remember being on Fox when the $80 billion came up. And when the $80 billion came up, and that we were going to give them this kind of money, everybody said, oh, this is terrible. You know, it'll never get paid back. Well, guess what? Most of it has gotten paid back so far.
Yep. And again, like I said on the show last night, it's a good thing. You know, nobody seen, you guys on Fox didn't seem to complain when we handed $80 billion away to the top 2% in this country. But since we helped people save their jobs and we helped create jobs, now you're squawking about it.
Exactly.
Doesn't make a lot of sense. I didn't hear anybody screaming when Bush gave away $550 billion in across-the-board tax relief to create a million new jobs, and those new jobs never came to fruition. So we handed out $550 billion for nothing. This actually showed some results.
Exactly. And it was a very specific targeted industry to remake cars in a way that would be competitive. And they've done that.
Yeah, and to me, I got to be honest, I think this is vital to our national security. I think having an auto industry, having a heavy manufacturing industry is vital to our national security.
No disagreement on that front. I think that's very important. I'm glad it's revitalized.
Yep. Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service, I appreciate your time. Look forward to talking to you again very soon.
You got it. Thank you.
All righty. And now what do you got going on for us tonight, Jake?
Yeah, it seems like the Republican effort to attack worker rights in some areas of the country, they have stubbed their toe, and they did it again in New Jersey. Apparently what has happened there, Rick, the Republicans tried to rush through some anti-worker legislation, which would take away basic state government rights, and in doing so, it annoyed several key members of the Republican delegation. These members were in key positions, and what they did as a reaction to what they were forced to do by the Republican leadership, they resigned their key positions in the New Hampshire legislature. In doing that, in voting against it, the Republican leadership tried to override the veto of the Democratic governor, and on that second vote, because of the defections by these key individuals, the Republicans lost. It's just another example of the Republicans stubbing their toe, and there are some isolated incidents where even Republicans in these legislatures have said, you know, enough is enough. I cannot do it because of my working class background. And that's great to see. It looks like that legislation will not go through. It looks like at this point, and I don't expect that to change, Rick, that they will not have the votes to override the veto of the Democratic governor, so that's good to see.
Good, good, good.
Some other good information coming out of Harrisburg, coming out of Pennsylvania. Harrisburg Patriot John Wetzel, he's the new Secretary of Corrections. He wants to change, at least he says publicly, wants to change the way that Pennsylvania handles prisons. It's one of the biggest changes we've seen in decades, according to Ann Schwartzman, who's the policy director for the Pennsylvania Prison Society. The Department of Corrections is rethinking prisons as we know them. Keys to the success in Pennsylvania and elsewhere are a support system in the community, housing, employment, and ongoing treatment and supervision. Wetzel said he recognizes the importance of reconnecting with children and family, the importance of having beds where your inmates come from. His redesign at Grida for Prison near Philadelphia adds a wing for female inmates about to leave the system. He's also instituting more partnerships with county jails where inmates will be sent home, within their communities. If an inmate is from Lancaster, he'll be sent to the Community Corrections Center in Erie. If, in fact, we do that in preparation for his release, we are not going about it in the wrong way, according to Wetzel. Ironically, prison spending is increasing. Prison spending has gone from about $94 million in 1980 to more than $1.8 billion last year. Wetzel is characteristically blunt. If you don't want to spend this much money, don't send me this many people. States like Texas that have successfully and safely cut their prison population and prison budgets have gone down so by spending money on intensive treatment programs at the local level to prevent people from entering the state system in the first place or from returning once they are released.
Wow, that's a tough one.
Well, he has some good proposals, some good sound proposals. The problem is how many of these recommendations are going to be taken up by the Corbett administration. It'll be interesting to see. Once again, the Massey situation rears its ugly head. The Big Branch mine where 29 miners were killed. The Massey Corporation was sold. Apparently, some of the key people in that company have been put on some key positions in the with the new mine owner, the Alpha Natural Resources. Some members of Congress have sent letters to the management saying, look, we don't think it's appropriate. These guys were intricately involved in this disaster that took the lives of 29 miners. Just to show you what labor thinks of it, here's Cecil Roberts, and you know I met him. I thought Cecil Roberts was a great man. I was really impressed by his dedication and his integrity. He's fighting a valiant fight right now. He has his hands full. United Mine Workers President Cecil Roberts was harsh in his criticism of Alpha's decision to retain Atkins and the others, calling it incomprehensible. Pointing to the GIIP, which is the government's independent investment panel report, indictment on Massey's corporate culture, Roberts says, who is directly responsible for the culture? None other than Chris Adams, Massey Energy Senior Vice President and Chief Operating Officer. This is the same Chris Adams who was in charge when the Arakoma Alkyne mine caught on fire and two miners were killed. This is the same Chris Atkins who asserted his Fifth Amendment rights against incriminating himself in the Upper Big Branch investigation and has yet to testify. Chris Atkins doesn't belong in Alpha's executive offices. He belongs in jail. And I heartily agree. Some of these execs, there's also a top lawyer that was put on in a key position. He was also involved in that. I mean, he claims that it was just some act of God, believe it or not, that caused that accident. I mean, these guys just have incredibly hubris. I mean, it was an act of God. No, it was an act of deliberate. What's the right word here? Deliberate and I think criminal neglect and just turning your back on the safety standards that should have been prevalent in that mine. They deliberately and knowingly allowed those conditions to exist, and now we have 29 members died. It'll be interesting to see how many, where these people line up. Instead of being rewarded with millions of dollars in a handsome salary, they actually should be in jail or at least under indictment. Back to you, Rick.
All righty, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to wrap things up.
Thought-provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
The 19th century saw regular work weeks of 70 hours or more. Many attempts were made to get legislatures across the country to pass maximum hour laws limiting the number of hours an employee could be compelled to labor. The first union victory in capping work hours was won by the building trades in 1840. They won a 60-hour week. In 1874, the state of Massachusetts became the first to pass a law mandating a maximum hours for women. Other states followed as union activists around the country fought to pass laws to protect workers. Their work stalled in 1905 when the U.S. U.S. Supreme Court ruled the New York Bake Shop Act unconstitutional, citing a sacred bond between master and employee and the liberty of contract. With this decision, the Lochner error, named after bakery owner Joseph Lochner, who had been cited, tried, and convicted of working employees beyond the 60-hour limit, began. This single decision opened the floodgates, allowing attacks on child labor laws, minimum wage laws, as well as maximum hour laws by corporate and anti-union interests. Only after President Franklin Delano Roosevelt threatened to enlarge the United States Supreme Court from 9 to 13 did the court do an about-face with regard to liberty of contract and what has been called a switch in time to save 9, ruling in West Coast Hotel versus Parrish that Elsie Parrish was indeed entitled to the state of Washington's minimum wage, regardless of what conditions she agreed to, marking the end of the Lochner era. FDR's New Deal policies helped workers reclaim lost ground in their fight for the American dream. The proposal and passage of the Fair Labor Standards Act, federally restricting weekly hours, mandating overtime pay, setting a minimum wage, and restricting the exploitative use of child labor was an essential step forward for workers, families, and communities. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center of IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Baby, get on the Herman Crane, Herman Cain train. Yeah. I've now revised Rick Santorum. You have been bumped off the Palin Santorum 2012 ticket. You're done. Because you don't have the Cain train. You got the Palin bus and the Cain train. Yeah, baby, I got a train.
Herman Crane train. Say that 10 times.
Yeah, right. Good luck on that one. But again, you know, there's a guy, you know, kind of trying to be the, you know, the Tea Party guy out there talking about, you know, the Constitution. We got, you know, we need to have the Constitution. We need to have people rereading the Constitution. Constitution important. Or as he says here,
you don't need to rewrite the Constitution of the United States. Rewrite it.
No.
We need to reread the Constitution and enforce the Constitution.
You bet you.
And I know that there are some people that are not going to do that. So for the benefit of those that are not going to read it, because they don't want us to go by the Constitution.
Preach the good word.
A little section in there that talks about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Huh? Where? Did I miss that? He goes on again. Maybe just a little slip up. You know, one time, forgive a mistake.
Get to the part about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Don't stop right there. Keep reading. Because that's when it says, when any form of government becomes destructive of those ideals, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it. We've got some altering and some abolishing to do.
Let that absorb for a second. Just let it waft around. Because it kind of smells. A little stinky there. This is a guy who wants to run for president. Yet, talking about rereading the Constitution, Hermie, I would say that you read the Constitution. And maybe while you're at it, you know, the Declaration of Independence. But Herman had a response.
Needless to say, without thinking.
Needless to say, I did it without thinking. Just what I want, a president who doesn't think. I want a reactionary president. I want a guy, and I do, I've been thinking about this, I've been thinking a lot. I want a guy like me, who's a hothead, who's going to, you know what, push that button, nuke those people. But Mr. President, they sent you a Christmas card a day late. I don't care. They should be more responsible. That Christmas card should have been on time. Nuke them. Yeah, I want a president like that. I want a president who every slight is going to be met with nuclear annihilation. I want a guy who someone's going to say something bad about him. He's going to send in federal troops to take him out. He's going to send in SEAL Team 6 to put two in the head. Man, what a, you know? Again, you know, I think Palin Kane, 2012.
Dream team.
The insane tour, the insanity tour. Bring the insanity. Bring it to the house.
I gotta tell you, this guy doesn't sound any worse than the whole broad spectrum of Republican candidates. He's right in the middle. As far as ignorance and stupidity, he doesn't stand out.
No, he's right there with Michelle Bachmann, who's now saying, my joy would be to debate President Obama. Look, honey, I don't think you'd beat that 10th grader from New Jersey who wants to debate you, let alone President Obama. But again, you know, what I love about these right-wingers, this bloated self-esteem, this hyperactive self-esteem, and maybe this is, you know, I've been thinking about this a little bit. Maybe this is the result of the whole education process trying to foster self-esteem. Maybe we've given these people too much self-esteem without them actually having to earn it. And, you know, you look at most of these politicians, you know, someone like her. You know, she's easy on the eye. She's willing to stand up and make a speech and say dumb things, and people clap, and, oh, yeah, we love her, and they vote for her. Most people like you and I, we don't like standing up in a crowd and talking to people. It's the last thing we want to do. These people like her, like Palin, like Bachmann, they thrive on it.
Well, Michelle's from a very heavily Republican district, and thank God that's not really an indication of the broad spectrum of political thought in the country. I mean, when she comes up to the Northwest and some of the industrial states, she will not have a prayer.
But, oh, please win Iowa.
Oh, please. And she might.
She's going to. She's
and she very, she might. Iowa. I'm not going to say very well might. She has a legitimate shot.
Absolutely she does. You know, people like local. You know, she's from Water. She was born in Waterloo, Iowa.
That's her home state.
And, you know, the chances are the folks there are going to go, we like our hometown girl. Crazy as she is, you know, with the third eye over here and the hump on her back, we still love her.
All kidding aside, the Republicans in Iowa tend to be on the conservative side, so she's got a real shot.
Please, please, please. You know, I always said that Bush could make a comedian out of anyone. I think Bachmann could easily be that figure that could make a comedian out of anyone.
Shooting fish in a barrel for 4 years. Almost unfair. Yeah, George was good for one a day.
He was good to misunderestimate. He was good, you know, to make sure that human beings and fish could coexist peacefully. He was good for putting food on your family. He's good for that too. And he wanted wings to fly. He wanted that too. See, a lot of things George wanted, and you know, but a lot of things George didn't understand. And of course, I'm sure Dick Cheney did it all for him. Boy, please. Oh, I'm loving this. Just loving it. Here's a story. One of these moments of clarity where you go, there's really something wrong with the Westboro Baptist Church. And we've known this for a long time. There are a bunch of cuckoo cadoos way out on the plank there. But when the Virginia branch of the Ku Klux Klan participates in a counter demonstration to you, you know you have a problem. You know that you are out on an island unexplored. You ventured into uncharted waters. When the Virginia Ku Klux Klan comes out against you and stands with some hippie liberal groups and everybody else and looks semi-normal, I think you've gone too far.
Was this the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan? There's several of them.
I don't know. I'm not a Klan aficionado. There you go. Anyway, I want to thank all of our guests for being here tonight. Thank you. If you missed any portion of the program, again, thericksmithshow.com to download the podcast. We'll see you back here tomorrow night.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@thericksmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk. It's coming, time is
blood beneath the lunar sway. Imperial, mysterious, in amorous array. The must is coming.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Understanding of what it means to be in the U.S. military. It just absolutely upside down, backwards, and sideways reasoning. But then comes this line, because, you know, Alan West is black. And taking on some gay hate when you're black is, you know, well, I mean, there's a sort of a wide open conflict there, right? That bigotry against one is okay, but not against, you know what I'm saying?
Yes, and by the way, I'm still confused. Yes.